We will call the meeting of the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims to order. Welcome, everyone. We have some new membership from the House, so first we want to welcome the new members from the House. My co-chair for, I guess, the next 2 years will be Representative Lyle Coonan. Representative Coonan and I came in together in the same class in the House, but we've never had the pleasure of serving on the committee together, so I'm very happy to be able to serve with you and the co-chair with you. And Representative Mary Murphy is also here and brings many years of experience and judgment to this committee, so we look forward to sharing the rooms together the few times that this committee meets. As you know, the claims often are small in dollar value, but are very significant for the people bringing them, and we try to bring that kind of seriousness to the to our work here, as we do to everything else that we do. So, if you have any questions about procedure or history, if some of these claims have actually occurred before us before and are coming back for some new proceedings, jump right in, ask whatever questions you feel you need to know. Or whatever we can. Mr. Wendicke here is our institutional knowledge for this committee. Not only has he been around for many years, but he's served very ably as counsel for this committee for many years, and knows the history of just about everything that's before us.
Senator Lapps, I'm afraid you're putting too much of a burden on me by saying all of that. Thank you.
Well, you can handle it.
Mr. Chair, I'm pleased to be here, and I would like to tell the people in the audience that I'm not, if I pop up and leave, it's not because I'm disinterested or don't care. It's because I've been scheduled in two places at one time. And there are people downstairs on a bill that I have, whose testimony I have to hear this morning, too. So I will pay attention to what's going on, and they know where I am, so I can come back for the vote.
All right. I think we have the same problem with it. I know Senator Hahn has a problem. You've got the same problem, Senator Olsen. Hopefully Representative Anderson will be able to join us. He might be at one of the other meetings. We can't officially vote on any of the claims unless we've got a quorum present on both sides.
And a quorum is?
Which is a majority of the House members and a majority of the Senate members must be present. So two. At least two from each body. So if we hear testimony and we don't have a quorum present on each side to take a vote, we will delay making a decision on that particular claim until we do have enough people here to make a decision. So I think the first, I don't know if you guys even got a chance to meet Senator Olsen and Senator Hahn, but welcome to everyone. Our first order of business then will be to approve the minutes from our last meeting, December 29, 2008. Obviously, the Senate members were here, the House members were different, but we still have to approve the minutes. So, is there anyone who'd like to make a motion?
I'll move approval.
Senator Olsen moves approval. Is there any discussion, any corrections to the minutes that anyone sees? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, the minutes are approved. Okay, Mr. Wendicke, would you like to take us through the first claim that we'll get to? Here is item number two, claims against the Department of Revenue, Mary Egg. Mr. Wendicke?
Mr. Chair, this is a claim for a lost property tax refund. Ms. Egge, who is from Forest Lake, I believe she's here. Perhaps we should have her come up and get seated. And Senator Vanderveer was with her. Ms. Egge submitted a property tax refund, she said, mailed it on the 10th of April of 06 to get her 05 property tax refund. She says she was a victim of mail theft from her rural mailbox. She resubmitted on December 10th of 07 And when that was received by the Department of Revenue, it was too late. It was beyond their deadline for issuing a property tax refund. The Department of Revenue, in their denial letter, apparently is unsure that the first letter was ever mailed, but the first return was ever mailed. But now we have Ms. Eggy here to explain exactly what happened, which we apparently did not at the December 29th meeting.
Ms. Eggy, welcome, and Senator Vandiver, welcome to the committee. We did have some discussion about this matter on the December 29th agenda, we now welcome you to give us your perspective on what happened. So please go ahead.
Good morning. I brought a copy of the police reports and the articles pertaining. Should I pass them, or are you interested?
Well, so do we have the reports? Just so you know, we do have some information that was submitted with the claim as well. We certainly welcome any additional information you have.
I only have one.
There's only one copy.
Okay. The residents.
So the record, Ms. Eggy, for the record, we'll note that she submitted a copy of a number of documents here. It includes the Forest Lake Police Department report, which I do not see in our packet. But there are some other documents she has submitted which are in the packet. An article from the newspaper, a copy of the 2005 property tax refund application, her April 2006 calendar, the notice from the Department of Revenue. I think those are all included in the packet that we have. In any case, I'll pass these around to the committee members as well.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm here because of my property tax refund not arriving, and the residents in our area are continuously having our mail stolen, and the police do not seem to be able to help us in a lot of ways, and I obviously have my reports. I mailed my federal property tax on April 10th, and my property tax also on April 10th, 2006. At that time, my mom was 91 years old, living alone and with a heart condition, and in the hospital and out of the hospital. I was preoccupied with her care. And on April 22nd, 2006, I found again mail in the ditch. This happens quite often. I reported it to Postmaster Daniel Stark, who requested that we continuously do this. And then on 2007, when I was mailing my 2006 federal and state returns, my mom just passed away, and it was a hard time for me, and that's when I did it, not right on time. I realized I did not have my 2005 refund, and I resubmitted it with my 2006 ones, and I received a denial for that on December 19th, 2007, by the Minnesota Department of Revenue, which I guess you have copies. I submitted an appeal to the Minnesota Department of Revenue as I requested, and on February 19th, 2008, I received a denial on that same 2005 property tax refund. On April 21st, 2008, for assistance, I spoke with Peter Schultz, supervisor of the Minnesota Department of Revenue, Ward Ines, commissioner of revenue, and Representative Bob Detmer and Senator Ray Vandiver. And Senator Vandiver advised that perhaps the committee could help me, the Joint Senate Committee could help me. So that's why I'm here. I'm here to ask you please grant my request to grant my refund on my 2005. We're still finding mail in our ditches continuously. My I mailed mail as late as my last mail, missing February 2nd of this year. I mailed a Medica payment and a birthday card, and they still, no one still, the, neither of those either turned up. And so the postmaster said there's no records of us calling him when the neighbors continuously call him. So I called the federal part of the post office. They do not have records either. And our postmaster saying he turns those records in, but there's no records on the federal level either. I guess I did bring along a witness. Thomas Bartleby was with me when I put the mail in the box. He put the mail in the box for me, if you'd like to have him witness that.
Sure, that's fine. Why don't you add him forward? Sir, welcome to the committee. Please identify
yourself. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Thomas Bartleby, a friend of Mary Agee, and I wish to state that I have a personal recollection of placing that mail in the little mailbox because it was a day when she had asked me to drive her to a hospital because her mother was having a pacemaker installed. And I recall as I put the mail in the mailbox, which I knew was her property tax refund request, that well, this is a positive aspect of the day, her property tax refund being sent out. And of course, the unfortunate part of the day was the concern about her mother having a pacemaker installed. So I do have a personal recollection of that event, placing it in the mailbox, raising the flag. I also have witnessed on at least one occasion driving down that road that there was mail from the neighbors and mail from other area of Forest Lake Township laying in the ditch. And I have also had to replace her mailbox on two different occasions from vandalism because pranksters driving down the road striking it with a sledgehammer or a baseball bat or something. But other neighbors have had that problem as well. So there has been an incidence of vandalism and mail theft in the neighborhood that I have witnessed.
Officer Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, speaking as your institutional memory, I'd like to say that a couple of times in the past that I recall, I didn't bring the cases today, but they were both in claims bills in the past. A couple of times in the past, we have directed the Department of Revenue to issue property tax refunds to people who had a legitimate excuse for not having gotten them in time. And so it's not unprecedented for us to order this kind of a refund if one believes the excuse for not having gotten it to them in time.
Thank you, Mr. Lundicke. Sir, we've been provided with a copy of a calendar as well. And according to the Department of Revenue's response, it indicates that there's a calendar entry that refers to the filing of the 2005 federal income tax return as well. Do you know, was that included in the mail that was there? Because this April 10th calendar says mailed federal and Minnesota property tax refund.
I only recall the Minnesota one because that's the one that stuck in my mind because I knew that was a property tax refund. And that's the one that I recall. I think it's a yellow envelope that one applies for the property tax refund. And I specifically remember mailing that one.
And do you know how many pieces of mail you put in the mailbox?
I recall more than one piece. I don't remember specifically how many pieces.
Any members of the committee have a question for the witness? Senator Olson?
I did notice that Mr. Lenneke had addressed some concerns on the back. I'd like him to maybe ask those questions at the time.
All right. Well, the concerns that I expressed when I reviewed this claim the first time. Were one that Ms. Egge apparently did not notice that she hadn't received her property tax refund and did not contact the department until apparently December of that year, requesting her property tax refund. At that time, she resubmitted her request. There's no indication that anybody could find that she had contacted the department in between to ask, where's her property tax refund? That's the one question that I have.
So that was between April 2006 and December 2007?
That's correct.
So about a year and a half.
That is correct, and I'm negligent. I just, no other excuse. I didn't realize it until I did my 2006, and I put the refund stubs in the file from the year before, and I didn't have a refund stub. I'm honest to God, that's the truth. I didn't realize it. My mother was ill. I was terribly traumatized, but it was bad to not.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, I'm very sympathetic to mail theft. We had a couple issues with mail theft, and I finally cut a hole in my mailbox and put a lock on there, so ours is locked for our incoming mail. We have to unlock it to get our stuff. But
oh, good idea.
I was going to try to get a patent, but somebody already had.
good idea.
This could easily, if there was a track of her records, because in 2004, she probably has property tax income return, and in 2006, so if there's a pattern, and obviously one year is missing, then I see no problem in supporting this. So I wonder where we might be able to see that, or if you might have a record of, you know, your previous returns.
I have a refund
past,
every year. Yes, I do. I have a refund every year.
So then
year.
With just one year missing, I mean, that really validates your story.
We do have Mr. Walzer from the Department of Revenue here who could perhaps respond to some of the questions. I don't know.
Well, let's just single hand that question first, I think, for the witness.
No, not for the witness.
Okay. That's fine. We'd also like to welcome Representative Anderson here to the table. Glad to have you here. Mr. Walzer, why don't we ask Ms. Egge, was there anything else that you wanted as part of your presentation?
Not unless you have any questions.
I did, Mr. Walls, if you'd wait just a minute, I did have a question.
Yes.
Also for Ms. Egge. The Department of Revenue did note that even though on your calendar you say that you mailed a federal tax return on April 2006, April 10th, it noted that as far as they could tell, you were not eligible for a 2005, or did not have to file a 2005 federal tax return.
I still filed, though.
So even though you did not,
yep,
you didn't have
did.
Enough income to need to file, you
right.
filed anyway?
Because I thought I had to submit a copy to my federal and state, and I did. I filed all three of them.
Okay. That was a question I had. All right. Any other questions from the committee at this time? All right. Why don't we ask Mr. Walzer from the Department of Revenue to come forward.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question from Mr. Walzer, too.
Mr. Lindicke, go ahead.
I hope it's an easy one.
Well, I think it is, Mr. Walzer. Perhaps Mr. Walzer should identify himself first for the record.
Good morning, members of the subcommittee. My name is Rick Walzer. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue, and I'm here to speak in response to the legislative claim filed by Mary Kay Egge. Should I wait for your question?
Well, let me just ask the one question that I have, and that is at the end of the letter from Mark Peterson of the Department of Revenue, it says, based on the numbers on the return, the taxpayer properly filled out the property tax refund claim. That indicates that apparently that would be the amount that she's entitled to get back. And then it says, however, the Department of Revenue has never conducted a review of the correctness of the numbers on the return. In particular, the department has never examined whether the taxpayer has underreported items of taxable or non-taxable income, et cetera, et cetera. I'd just like to hear you discuss that paragraph and whether if the subcommittee were choosing to refund to direct that she get this refund of $1,407. From your point of view, would that be the right amount?
Mr. Walzer?
Mr. Lindeke, this property tax refund claim has not been audited. If it was audited, it might turn out to be correct, but it's an unaudited claim at this point. But the mathematics on the return are correct. Can I proceed with?
Yeah, Mr. Walzer, go ahead. It was the department's perspective.
Thank you. Thank you, members. It's hard for me to dispute what may or may not have occurred with the claimant's nail problems. All I can tell you is that both our appeals office and the taxpayer rights advocate were not convinced that this actually happened, but that doesn't mean it did not happen. But I would stress to the committee that a property tax refund claim is not a tax refund in the true sense of the word. This is clearly a benefit program, and that's why the legislature clearly established a one-year deadline to file these claims, because these people are not being refunded an overpayment of tax. It is, in actuality, a benefit program. And I would point out that in December, on December 29th, when this committee met, Mr. Yuri Farber had a very similar claim, a late property tax refund return under similar circumstances, and this committee denied his claim. So I would urge the committee to look at Minnesota statutes Section 289A.40, Subdivision 4, which in no uncertain terms says that a property tax refund claim under Chapter 290A is not allowed if the claim is filed more than 1 year after the due date. The law does not provide for asking for an extension. The law does not provide for any extenuating or equitable circumstances. It's a flat deadline, and that's what the legislature has decided in how these laws should be administered. And that is what the committee decided back in December when Mr. Yuri Farber's claim was denied. So I would urge the committee to also deny this claim as well. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Walzer. Senator Olson?
Which goes to my question of, is if she has a record of previous years having this refund and after 2005 having that refund, to me, then we would clearly know that something happened in 2005. So do you have that information with you? Previous, if she had a tax refund, property tax refund previous to that and after that?
Senator, I did not bring a printout of her entire filing history, but I don't deny that's an accurate statement. But even if it is an accurate statement, our position is that the legislature has determined that when these property tax refund returns are filed late, there's beyond the flat one-year deadline, no refund is allowed. So I would argue that even if there are extenuating circumstances for this one-time occurrence, the statutes simply do not allow the claim to be paid.
I would move payment of this claim of $1,407 what would you do, an audit to verify it?
Yes, we would do an audit to verify.
To verify the numbers correct.
Mr. Lindeke?
Could I ask Mr. Walzer, just out of curiosity, how much money would be spent doing an audit of this property tax refund claim. How much would that cost the people of Minnesota?
Mr. Walzer?
Mr. Lindeke, we do these audits all the time. They are fairly routine. I don't have an exact dollar figure, but...
So not a lot?
No, not a lot. We could do it fairly quickly.
Is there any further questions of Mr. Walzer or discussion from the committee or questions of Ms. Eggy? Ms. Timmons, you were here at the December 29th meeting, right?
Yes, I was.
We had was Mr. Farber's case on the agenda for that meeting?
Yes, it was, but I think the difference in that case was based on the facts. That on the facts in that case, the committee chose to deny the particular claim.
That was the case, if I remember right, where you had family distress and got tied up in a divorce, I think, and had issues and didn't follow up on the property tax issues. Is that right?
Correct.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson?
I should probably amend my motion to say that upon the audit, that the payment would be whatever the audit was, because it might not be the 14.07. So I would amend that.
Motion's amended. In Mr. Farber's case, I think the committee's conclusion to deny the claim was based at least in part on the fact that he continued to maintain his other obligations for a year or two after it, and although he was declaring that he was basically immobilized and therefore unable to follow up on his claim, I think we could legitimately ask the same question here: is why was there a year and a half delay? And I understand the family circumstances could people distracted. And there's some obligation with the law anyway to follow up. Senator Hamm?
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to remember that case too, and maybe someone else. Did that individual actually file the claim? Or I think he was stating that he didn't actually file the claim in time, but he was trying to. Does anybody recall what this? It seems like it was different circumstances.
He didn't file it initially?
Yes.
And then he remembered it late, but I'm seeing a lot of heads nodding from the.
That's my recollection, that he did not file the claim at all, that there wasn't a claim, that the claim was timely filed and then stolen out of the mailbox. It was a different set of facts, that he was so distracted by the family circumstances of a very difficult divorce that he did not file the claim at all.
It was a couple of years after that that he was trying to...
Until it was after the deadline for even late filing the claims. That's my recollection.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess in this case I'm kind of leaning in favor of Senator Sue's motion, and that, unless there's evidence to the contrary that this is not, you know, she's had refunds in the past and since that time and has made the statement that it was lost or stolen, we no evidence one way or the other to validate that, I guess, but I guess I would. To me, there's not fraudulent behavior on the part of the claimant. The extent that the claim is valid, I think we ought to try to make the money.
Is there any further discussion? Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I guess I would agree with Representative Senator Holcein that if upon the audit they find that she has had past valid property tax returns to her, and after that, at least the audit should at least bear that out and give us conclusive evidence on that. So I would support Senator Lucien's motion.
Any further discussion, Mr. Walzer?
Members of the committee, I did bring a copy of Mr. Yuri Farber's claim with me, and one of his statements was that his His refund request forms were lost in the mail. That was part of his actual legislative claim. So I do believe the cases are similar.
I'm remembering, this is the security guard or prison guard, and it sounded like his wife was trying to sabotage a lot of his stuff. So I think they are clearly different circumstances. That was kind of a hostile divorce, if I remember right. There was some hanky-panky going on, if I remember right also.
That legal term?
Need a legal definition on that.
All right, any further discussion? All in favor of Senator Olsen's motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, we'll move on to the next item on the agenda, the claims against the Department of Administration, Iron Range Resources, the matter of Aaron Cross. Who's going to present this claim for us?
Mr. Chair, I believe that you, Mr. Cross is here. Aaron is over there in the wheelchair, I believe. Could you come up to the witness table? And the members who were here for the December 29th meeting, I wasn't here myself, but apparently there was a good deal of discussion concerning Mr. Cross's case. Mr. Cross broke his neck and is paralyzed. It happened during a bike race accident in 1991 at Giants Ridge. Apparently the IRRRB is the organization that owns or runs Giants Ridge. The van in front of him stopped abruptly. Mr. Cross couldn't stop abruptly enough and ran into the back of the van and became paralyzed. There was a trial in his lawsuit against several people, including Giants Ridge, in 1994. Prior to the trial, the Giants Ridge IRRRB people and Mr. Cross reached what was called a high-low agreement. If Mr. Cross won, they would pay $100,000. If he lost, they would pay $10,000. The decision by the jury was that Giants Ridge was 0% negligent. Mr. Cross was I believe 51% negligent, and the other person involved was 49% negligent. So they, in effect, said Giants Ridge was not liable for any of Mr. Cross's damages. $10,000 was paid to Mr. Cross at that time under the high-low agreement. This seems to have been thoroughly litigated, but and I wasn't here on December 29th, so I don't know how much discussion there was from Mr. Cross of this, but at that time, the claim was, I believe, put off because there was no one here from the Department of Administration Risk Management Office to respond. So that's where we are on this claim.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lindeke. First, I should ask, is there someone here from the Department of Administration?
Yes.
Okay. Then let's first hear from Mr. Cross. We'll note from Mr. Cross that, you know, we do have the materials in front of us as well. Although we have some members on the committee that were not part of the committee in December. So go ahead and give us a brief summary of your situation, if you would, but assume a certain amount of knowledge on the part of the committee already. Okay?
Mr. Chair, one Mr. more Lundin. Thing, just in passing. Mr. Cross's uncle, I believe, who was here just a moment ago and had to leave for some dental work, is the former reviser of statute, Steve Cross. So he used to be my uncle.
Good thing you left. Mr. Cross, I wish you had told us that your uncle had to leave, or we could have adjusted the agenda order to accommodate his schedule.
That's okay. We can work it out somehow.
Okay. Why don't you take a few minutes, though, to summarize for us why you believe that you're entitled to recovery, especially under the circumstances where there's already been a completed litigation and a high-low agreement that you signed.
Well, I appreciate the time, Senators and Representatives, for having it back. One of the things that, popped up at the last meeting that we were talking about, was it really December?
Yes.
Good Lord. Back in December, the question was brought up that the state paid for my medical bills. And that, in fact, was not, in fact, true at all. My family's insurance, both of their insurance, paid for my medical bills. And we had our own out-of-pocket money when it came to myself, and my family had their own, my mother and father had out-of-pocket bills. So that was one of the things that was brought up in the last meeting, is that we wanted to double-check that. In fact, it came out to be that my family paid for the medical bills, and our insurance paid for the medical bills.
Mr. Cross, do you know how much your out-of-pocket medical expenses were?
We have some of the documentations, but off the top of my head, no, I have no idea. I can just tell you this. It cost me $2,300 to go to the bathroom a month, and that's only in catheter bills. We've been doing that since 95. So insurance has been paying for it, but we've been doing the spend downs and everything else along with that. So it's quite expensive to go pee, apparently. It also came, basically, you're right, the accident did go to court. It was asked to me why they filed, saw it as my fault. I can't answer that except for the point that in the state of Minnesota, when you hit something from behind, it's your fault. Even under testimony, when the driver of the van said, I saw him come around the corner and I watched him right up into the back of the van and I didn't say a thing. When it comes to that, he was the representative of the race organizers, and the race organizers, the sponsors of the race, was Giants Ridge, which was the a state-funded park, and that's where it all came in.
Mr. Cross, if I remember right, the driver of the van was a volunteer, and your claim was that Giants Ridge had not properly trained the volunteer to drive safely in that kind of a circumstance, a bicycle race. Is that right?
That is correct. The driver of the van stopped, parked the van in the road, not pulling off completely on the road because he did not want to get mud stuck on the van. And he was not informed, or if he was, he did not follow through with the fact that when you do a fixing of a bike, he had stopped to help another cyclist out. And he did not do the work behind the vehicle. He did the work in front of the vehicle. And he did not send the spotters out like he was supposed to either.
Okay, so this was not a matter of the vehicle stopping suddenly in front of you. It was a matter of him stopping earlier, parking improperly, you allege. And when you came along, you were unable to avoid a collision. Is that
correct? That is correct.
Okay. Senator Hand?
Thank you, Chairman. I have two questions. One is the issues that you're raising, Mr. Cross, I'm assuming were raised in the court proceeding. And the document we have says that they found the driver of the van actually about half, 49% negligent, so it made fair evidence to the point you're making that he didn't perhaps do the things that he should have done in the way he should have done them. But they did not find the Giants Ridge organization negligent at all. So I guess if there would be any culpability that should be pursued, why wouldn't it be pursued against the individual rather than Giants Ridge, given the
case? Because at that point in time, he got the instructions from Giants Ridge employee, the race director, and the race director was an employee of the state.
Senator Allen, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Cross, I'm not disputing that, but I'm just, my question is, it would seem to me that those issues would have been the subject of the litigation, and they would have made a determination of the validity of that claim, and what we have would say that they didn't accept that as accurate, that they said, well, whatever went on, it was not the responsibility of Giant Spirits. They bore no culpability they had no negligence with respect to this incident. And that's my question, is if the court has said that the fault lies between you and the other person and not at all with the agency, why then would the claim be brought to the state? And I'm just assuming, maybe I'm wrong, that the court has looked at the things that you're saying and made a ruling, that we have a document that speaks to that. And what I'm concerned about, I guess, is that you're suggesting that we should override the determined findings of the court and find fault that Giants Ridge should bear, and that as a result of that, that we should pay a claim on the basis of that fault, even though the court found none.
Mr. Cross, did you have anything to respond?
I don't know how to respond to that, to be honest with you, except for the fact that we were always, say this, I don't know how to answer that question at this point in time. I wish I had a little more time to think about that answer, except for the point that if you're instructed by somebody of the state to do something specific, I don't know how to answer that question. I don't want to give you a lollygagged answer. I don't know how to answer that question to you right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then my second question would be, given that the incident occurred in 1991, as you said, and it's now 2009, and the court proceedings were in 1994, why is the claim brought so long after the fact of the incident and the court action?
That one I can't answer. My uncle, who has already left, was under the assumption that our lawyers had told us or given us all the opportunities to go after claims against the state and all the different options. We had not been given those options or not told those options. And it wasn't until the unfortunate incident with the I-35 that my uncle remembered about the claims department, the claims committee. And he thought, well, have you guys gone through that avenue? And so we looked at that avenue, and we just started to bring it out. So it wasn't until that unfortunate incident. Basically, I had tried to move on with my life, and my uncle thought this might be an avenue to look at to see if we can't get any type of, I think the right word would be reciprocation, for all the funds that we put out for this and did not get anything from the state on the aspect. That makes sense. It does in my head.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Lundicke.
So, Mr. Cross, my former employee, your uncle, had forgotten all about
it. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude. Let's just make this clear. I don't want this, because every time you say that, I'm looking at hearing bias, and I want this clear. Well, my uncle hasn't worked for the state, and it was probably 10, 15 years before
Mr.
my
Cross,
accident.
We are not going to consider in any way, shape, or form any previous employment history of your family in connection with the state or the legislature.
Okay, I was just going to ask, Senator.
If it's connected to anything related to that, then we shouldn't.
The statement you made is that he did forget until just recently about the claims subcommittee's existence. Okay.
I nodded yes for the record.
This is probably not the first time that we're going to see claims that are resulting from the fact that the claims committee became known in the community because of the role the claims committee played in the 35W bridge collapse. So we'll just leave it at that. that, I suppose. Do any members of the House have any questions for Mr. Cross? I want to hear from the Department Administration as well. Senator Hannah, do you have a question?
Well, it's not for the witness, so I can wait till you hear.
Okay. Let's hear from the Department Administration.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Chuckle. I'm with the Department of Administration, Risk Management Department, and I'm the claims manager.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Give us the department's perspective on this.
Okay. The first thing I've got to point out is that the state's file on this has been destroyed a long time ago. We have a file retention policy that is based on retaining files as long as the statutes of limitations might be open where someone can file a claim against the state. So we can no longer reconstruct what happened to any great detail. And it's been almost 18 years. What we do have are a few bits and pieces. And as far as the facts of the case go, the only difference, with all due respect to Mr. Cross, was that we find, excuse me, in racing, there are two types of races, one involving an open course and one involving a closed course. This particular race was an open course, which means other vehicular traffic would be expected to be on this road. We do have a record indicating Mr. Cross was not looking up. He was trying to make up some ground to finish the race. And it was at that time he ran into the parked vehicle. All this is kind of vague and fuzzy. We still have one gentleman at Giants Ridge that it works there that was around at the time of the race. And that's his recollection of the facts. So we have a jury verdict, and that's really as much as we can determine from our department.
Senator Hand?
I don't know, maybe the department can't answer this, but maybe the witness can. In these types of races, you mentioned an open race, and it's, when I was younger, I used to do some things that were a little bit more extreme. And it's not unusual that when you do something, there's a assumption of risk, and sometimes even a document that you're asked to sign to in effect say, I recognize that what I'm doing is not normal activities, and that I bear responsibility. Was such a document executed on the part of Mr. Cross with respect to race?
It is unknown, but the defense of the case did, as far as the state goes, use that particular defense of the assumption of risk, yes.
And maybe Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cross, do you recall, were you asked to execute some kind of a document where you would take and make a statement to say that I understand what I'm doing is outside of normal kinds of activities and therefore, there's risk, and therefore, I assume it will harmless, whatever the people name the document. Was there such a document?
There's a document to enter the race, and I'm sure there was a parent guardian's signature because I was under the age of 18. You got to sign up for something. I'm sure there was something with that.
But Mr. Chairman and Mr. Cross, you don't recall whether that document had any kind of, it's not unusual in those kinds of
forms.
It's
not unusual to have a waiver to have something, and I'm sure there was something to the effect that you waived something. You know, I was in the race to win. My head was down. I was going balls to the walls, looking, watching. The one thing that I do know is that the police said if the van was 6 inches to the right, they would have missed it completely. So when the van is, they also said the van was 3/4 of the way in the road. That's another part of the case, but that's neither here nor there.
All right. Is there anything else from the department?
We can't verify the facts at this point, one way or the other.
Representative Anderson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, does the state on these type of, or like you say, you don't recall if there's anything that was there, but has it been a practice of the state to have since that or presently, do they have some type of a sheet, as Senator Hamm just mentioned, where participants have to sign documents of this nature to say they waive responsibility or they're aware of the risk that's being assumed here when they take on this race? Or, I mean, you say you don't remember that being available or you don't find anything in your documentation of that, but are there things like this today that, does this race still even exist?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have different organizations that use what they call hold harmless or liability waivers. They're not always upheld in court, and particularly if you're involving a person under 18. Whether they're currently conducting this race or not, I do not know. They do run a skiing operation there, and skiing is an inherently dangerous sport. The paperwork you sign for skiing, I think, has that type of liability waiver language. But I don't know if they're still running this race or not.
Senator Hamlin? Mr. Chairman, if he can respond, I'm trying to recall. I know we've got some statement of scope of authority as a committee, and as I recall, there's some statement of the effect that our authority extends where other authorities don't go. And I'm just wondering, if this has been in court and if this has had that jurisdiction, do we have jurisdiction at that point?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I can read you our Rule 1. The subcommittee shall not consider any claim over which another tribunal or court has jurisdiction. And the has doesn't necessarily, hasn't been interpreted to mean just right at this moment. The fact is that the court did have jurisdiction over this. And so, although our rules are just our rules and can be waived, our rule says that we shouldn't consider this claim because it has been litigated thoroughly in court.
There is precedent for this sort of being the last resort, even after claims have been litigated in court. If there was something still pending in court, or if there was still time for appeal of a district court decision, then I think we would be more reluctant to get involved at that stage. My own view is that Mr. Cross signed a high-low agreement in the district court prior to the jury trial, and he's now frustrated with the results of that agreement, but that he's bound by it. He signed a legally binding high-low agreement and went to jury trial and lost, and got the benefit of that high-low agreement, the $10,000 payment, where he would have gotten nothing from the state had he not signed that agreement. So that's one piece of it, and then the second piece is that there's, if Giants Ridge, it's not Giants Ridge's fault if they properly trained the volunteer, and the volunteer did something in violation of that training, that's not Giants Ridge's fault, that's the volunteer's fault, and it sounds like that's what the jury can do as well. And we don't really have any evidence to the contrary here. Is there any further discussion on this claim, or does anyone have a motion?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Hahn,
based on what I guess I feel compelled to move to deny the claim. I guess we all are sympathetic with the claimant's accident and how unfortunate it is, but I am concerned by the fact that it has been litigated, and as you stated, there was an agreement that was binding that was entered into, the passage of time and the difficulty of reconstructing all the facts, the question of the scope of this committee, and there may be some doubt as to that. I think for all those reasons, I think we should deny it. Can I make a motion?
Is there any discussion on the motion? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Cross, I'm sorry that he's denied your claim. The next claim on the agenda is against the Department of Labor and Industry in the matter of Stephen Craig Hatcher. Mr. Lindeke? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I believe Mr. Hatcher is here.
Yes, sir.
Perhaps you'd come up and have a seat at the witness table, and I'll tell people a little bit about what your claim is.
I'm just wondering how long you're going to be in session, because I plan to be very lengthy. So if there are some other claims that might be shorter, I would waive my time right now so that I can discuss my whole matter in length and in detail.
Mr. Hatcher, we're scheduled to go until 1:30 today. We will adjourn at 1:30. And so what do you mean by lengthy?
Well,
do you have an attorney who's going to be appearing on your behalf as well, or are you representing yourself?
I am representing myself. I have been looking for an attorney, but I haven't been able to find one so far.
Okay. Well, you know, candidly, we don't have an hour and a half to listen just to your presentation, because we do have other matters on the agenda, whether it happens now or it happens later.
And that's been part of my problem in talking with people in the past. I've had Senator Pat Parasol out to my house, and she's quite devastated and upset with everything that's been going on for quite a long period of time. And I'm also working with Congressman Klein's office.
Okay. Well, we certainly wish you luck in those forums, but this is an independent forum, and we certainly welcome your testimony. Maybe I should ask, is there anyone else in the room that has a specific time commitment issue like we learned about in an earlier claim where they have to leave by a certain time to make another commitment? Okay. Sir?
I would like to be heard today. I don't think I can make it to another meeting.
Okay. And your name, sir?
Vernon Olson, against the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Well, we'll certainly make sure that you're heard today. I wonder if the, is there anyone else today? I wonder if, look, maybe what we should do then is complete the other items on the agenda. I'll certainly listen to the committee's input on this, but we could complete the other items on the agenda so that no one else gets squeezed out if we end up having to run to the end of the meeting with Mr. Hatcher's case. And then we'll call Mr. Hatcher when we've concluded the other matters. Is that okay with you, Mr. Hatcher? I appreciate
yes,
you noting ahead
of time. My other question is, if I don't get to finish today, when would I be able to come back and finish?
Well, this committee meets basically at the call of the chairs. It's not a regularly scheduled meeting, and so we don't have another committee meeting presently scheduled before the end of the legislative session, although we certainly could do that. But in order for a claim to be paid, if that were the determination of the committee, it would have to be done in time for this legislative session to pass a bill to that effect. So if it's the will of the committee to come back and to complete any presentation in your case, we could certainly attempt to do that in time to complete it for this legislative session.
Okay. I want to be fair with everybody, but at the same time, I want my time.
Mr. Hatcher, you will have your time, but you're not entitled to determine exactly how long that will be. We're not going to tie up the committee for 5 hours on one case unless it's a particularly unusual case that we determine needs that much time. So we do have the materials that you presented ahead of time as well, so the committee has had an opportunity to take a look at some of the materials and probably don't need to go through everything in the hearing itself. This is not a jury trial.
I really do.
That may be one question that we'll address as to whether or not you have other legal options aside from here that need to be dealt with before you make before this committee. But why don't you think about that?
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, let's move on with the agenda.
Okay, that's fine.
And it's our goal is to give everyone a fair hearing.
Okay.
But also to recognize everyone has certain limits on their availabilities. So.
Okay.
All right, thank you for letting us know of your anticipated presentation, Mr. Hatcher. So we will set aside Mr. Hatcher's claim and move on to the claim against the Department of Human Services in the matter of Robert Salido. In this claim, we're going to have testimony by telephone from Mr. Salido, who is a resident at the St. Peter Regional Treatment Center, I believe, or the RTC. He's in St. Peter, and also the staff person who's in connection with this will be testifying
by
telephone for St. Peter. Now, this is a property loss claim. Why don't we turn to that, Mr. Bendicke? Do you want to give us?
Shorter.
Maybe we should wait and see if we have. with music?
No music.
We gotta talk with the department about that.
Shall I present what I know about this claim first?
Sure. Mr. Lindeke, why don't you tell us what you know about?
Mr. Chair, this is, as you said, a claim against the Department of Human Services concerning a patient at the St. Peter Regional Treatment Center. On October the 9th of 08, the claimant says that he was being moved to Area 800. I gather that is like segregation, being sent to SEG in the prison or something like that. They packed up his stuff. He claims that they lost a lot of his CDs and a summer sausage, among other things. Compact disc player, headphones, batteries, and his claim is for $342.87. The response from the department, well, I won't go into that because they're here, they can tell you what their response is. But they somehow seem to know that somebody else ate his summer sausage and alleged that he didn't buy these CDs but burnt them.
Okay, do we have our...
I'm still on hold, I'm sorry, they're getting him, so, sorry.
Well, I'm reluctant to go any further without having the claimant available to listen to the testimony and respond as he feels is appropriate. So...
Ms. Nichols? Rosie, from the DHS is here too.
I understand we have some other witnesses on this case, but I'm reluctant to take testimony on it unless the claimant is able to listen to that testimony and respond. So they just said they're going to find him?
They're getting him out of a group session. They were under the impression that he was going to be available, that this case was going to be heard at 10:30, so. Yeah, so they said 2 minutes and they'll have them, so.
Okay, well, I don't think we can get the next item on the agenda done within those 2 minutes, so.
My apologies.
Mr. Chair, perhaps that the Department of Corrections has a claim for additional money for claims they've already paid. It would normally be about the last item on the agenda. Perhaps you could approve that.
That's a good idea, Mr. Lindsay. Is the Department of Corrections here to address that?
I think I have some copies of
just
that.
A written item for us.
Here is their, Mr. Chair, here is a copy of their claims request. It may be in everybody's file, I don't know. But we already, this is for an additional $1,234.90. It's dated March 13th of this year. Here's one, Senator.
It should be at the end of their files.
Perhaps we could just adopt that because we've already got in the claims bill you introduced an amount for claims already paid, and this would be an addition to that, as I understand.
Correct. These are claims for under 500 to the Center Team Service Program for, as you said, $1,234.90. And they're from claims paid from January 1st to March 13th.
Nicole Lind, could you please identify yourself?
Nicole Lind, Department of Corrections.
Thank you. And members, these are relatively routine procedures. Claims come in, if they're under $500 in value for each claim, the department goes ahead and makes their own decisions on whether to pay them. And then it's just a matter of us given the formal authority, and so that we can include it in our claims bill to reimburse the department for having paid those claims. So are there any questions from the for the department in connection with these? Looks like, is this sheet, Mr. Lindeke, being handed around? Is this in connection with that?
I don't know what it is. I just received it. Here's another one.
It's like the bill.
Is this what all these are?
Mr. Chair, Randy Hartnett from the Department of Corrections. Senator Latz, what this packet is that I have passed around it doesn't relate to the under $500 claims, but rather relates to those claims that the subcommittee heard last year, but after the bill had been completed. So these were claims that were approved by the subcommittee, but did not go into the claims bill.
Yes.
Okay. So, well, let's deal with the first item first, the claims of the department from the memo dated March 13th, sentenced to service and community work service medical expenses, claims under $500 in the amount of $1,234.50.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lynn or Mr. Hartnett, how many claims were involved in this time period between January 1 and March 13th for the $1,234.90? How many were there brought forward?
Representative Anderson, I don't have those figures with me, but I can get those to you. I would, if I had to guess, I'd probably say about 30 of them. They're relatively low-cost claims.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Lynn, are they basically all injury type?
Correct. They're all injury.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Hartnett?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the department is asked to administer any claim that is under $500. Now, because of the way medical bills work, what we have done is to assign the medical assistance payable rate to the claims that we have and then measure it as to whether or not it is $500 at that point. Otherwise, we would be probably bringing every claim forward to the subcommittee. So this represents those claims that were less than $500, what's the medical assistance rate, and they are completely sentenced to serve or community work services claims, and they relate solely to medical services. Examples are somebody gets in poison ivy while they're cutting weeds, they have to go into the clinic and have that checked out. Somebody steps on a nail, has to have a tetanus shot. Somebody sprains their ankle. That's the kind of claims that we have. They actually form the majority of our sentencing to serve claims. But when you look at, obviously, when somebody is more severely injured, the medical costs go up incrementally, and those are the claims that we have before you each individually.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions of the witnesses on these claims? Is there a motion relating to these the $1,234.90 claims?
Mr. Chair, I make a motion that the Claims Committee pay the $1,234.90 to the department.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, that was item number 7 on your agenda. You could just cross that off.
Do we need to take any action, Mr. Lindeke, with regard to the 2008 session claims submitted and left open?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, to refresh your memory, as you recall, we had one injury claim that was heard by the subcommittee prior to the claims bill being put forward. And in March, we had these claims that were also heard by the subcommittee, but not passed on to the full body at this point. We were asked to try to find funds to pay some of those, and the sentence to serve claims have been paid by our community services unit. The offenders who have permanency awards have not yet been paid. But these matters were approved by the board in the session in March of 2008.
Okay. So what you're asking then, so we've already taken action approving these claims, but you need them included in our claims bill this year.
Senator Latz, that's correct. And what I brought forward, this packet actually has a number of things that relate to our time before you this morning. The first two pages are the full list of both sentence to serve and inmate injury claims that were heard in March but not put into the claims bill. And the second sheet is the breakout of those claims that the DOC has already paid, so what we would be asking for would be reimbursement of that amount to the DOC because those funds came from our community services unit.
Mr. Hart, at the second page of the claims that were already paid, did we consider those claims already?
Senator Latz, yes, you did.
So all of these have already been approved?
All of these have been approved by the subcommittee, and I was asked to bring them forward this session.
I don't know that we need to take any action, do we? We've already approved these. We just need to include them in the claims bill this year. Is that the accurate?
I don't believe any action is needed, but I would certainly defer to Mr. Lindeke, who is going to be drafting the claims bill on this.
Well, I haven't, Mr. Chair, I have not been presented with one of these in prior years that I know of. So I'm not really familiar with this.
Do we know why it wasn't in the claims bill last year?
Senator Latz, when we came before the subcommittee last year in March, the subcommittee was in the throes of the I-35W bridge, and we were told that those claims simply would not be heard last session by the full legislature, that they were heard by this body. We were told to make whatever arrangements we could to pay the medical providers so they didn't have to wait an additional year. But under the understanding that both the full legislature and the governor had to approve the claims bill. At that point, that had not occurred.
Mr. Chair, perhaps the motion could be to include these amounts in this year's claims bill as a reimbursement to the department, subject to my review of each of these claims and each of these numbers, because I haven't seen them before today.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, you did review those claims last year prior to the March session.
But Mr. Chair and Mr. Hartnett, I did not see all of these numbers.
Each of these are the numbers that are taken off from the individual claims.
Right. I would want to look at them again.
So I would welcome a motion to include these claims in this year's claims bill, subject to Mr. Lindeke's verification that the action taken last year by the Claims Committee approved payments in these amounts.
Mr. Chairman, so moved.
Mr. Hartnett, would that meet the department's
Mr. Chair, it would. I just wanted to make sure that the subcommittee, that there wasn't any confusion. On the first page, you find awards that were granted by this subcommittee to Mr. Gale, Mr. Gosling, Mr. Muhammad, and Mr. Rainey. Those have not been paid by our department.
Okay, and they're waiting for?
They are waiting for a check, yes.
Okay. But we've already approved.
Yeah, they have been approved, but and the others have been paid, but by us rather than by the claims bill.
So noted. Is there any discussion on this matter? Senator Hannaford, made the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I think we're ready for St. Peter. We're ready for the St. Peter.
I hope we're not ready for St. Peter. Come soon enough.
All right, we'll return to item 5 on the agenda, the matter of Robert Salido. All right.
Can you hear that?
Yes, Mr. Salido?
Yes.
All right. Welcome to the Claims Committee.
Okay.
I'm Senator Ron Latz. I'm the co-chair of the committee.
Right.
And we have in the room here the other members of the Claims Committee. Senator David Hahn is present. Senator Rick Olsen is on the committee, has stepped out for another meeting. He may return during your presentation.
Okay.
Representative Lyle Coonan is the co-chair of this committee. He's present. Representative Bruce Anderson is here. And Representative Mary Murphy has also stepped out for another meeting. She may also return during your testimony or your case. You have, is there another person in the room with you at this time?
Yes. Yes, there is.
Okay, who is with you?
Matt Schrader, our unit director.
Okay, Mr.
And two of the security counselors.
Okay, I assume the security counselors are not part of these proceedings. They're just there to keep everyone safe.
Yeah, they're just here to watch.
Okay. Mr. Schrader, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
All right. Well, what we're going to do then is ask Craig Lindeke, who's the counsel for this committee, to give us on the record again a brief summary of the nature of the claim. And then we also have someone in the room here from the Department of Human Services who will also be responding on behalf of the department to the claim. And Mr. Salito, after Mr. Lindeke is done, we'll give you an opportunity to explain to us the nature of your claim and why you believe it should be paid. Mr. Lindeke?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Salito, my review of your claim indicates that indicates that on the 9th of October of last year, you were moved from Unit 700 to Unit 800. Now, I'm not familiar with your hospital, so I don't know exactly what that means. But during that move, you claim that they lost a good deal, that they failed to pack up or lost. In any event, you didn't get back a number of items, including a lot of CDs, a compact disc player, headphones, batteries, a disc case, and one summer sausage. And they claim that they're not responsible, that there was no staff negligence involved, that these losses are not their fault. That's the claim as I understand it.
Mr. Am I pronouncing your name right? Is it Salito?
Yes, it is.
All right. Sir, why don't you tell us what you would like to say with regard to your claim?
Okay, first of all, just to separate things, the summer sausage was lost while I was on Unit 800.
Okay.
And what happened is I had my CDs, my case, my batteries, and my CD player in a drawer in the staff office. And when we moved over, it never moved with my stuff. And on the reply I got for the denial of my claim, it says that it wasn't on the list of stuff that was in storage. We don't have an exact list of all our items. We just have a list of storage items, and it was never in storage. It was actually in the staff office. And that's pretty much what happened. I mean, I came over on an emergency transfer, and when I got out of seclusion, it wasn't in my personal items anymore. So it must have never made it from over there. That's what I'm claiming.
Okay. Are there any questions from members of the committee, the Mr. Salito? Representative Anderson?
Well, Mr. Salito, it says that the inventory of items was in a locked storage, and you're saying contrary to that, that it was not in locked storage?
No, it wasn't. I had some CDs in locked storage, but the CDs I had in locked storage, the reason they were in storage was because I had just burned them onto five CDRs. That I claimed five CDRs, right? And those had already been burned, so I put them into storage. So those actually I got back. I got back about like nine CDs. I don't know exactly how many, but it was around nine. But I lost 13 CDs that were still in a case that I never burned. That was also in the denial.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Salito. This is David Hand, one of the members of the committee. This property that you say that was not in locked storage was in some other place. Is it the practice then to have things stored for you that are not inventoried?
Yes. Yes.
And Mr. Chairman, would it be appropriate to ask I think there was indicated a staff person was there. Could that staff person maybe shed some light on that fact, and whether or not that is the case and how that works?
Mr. Schrader, would you like to respond to that?
Yes, there are items in the patient's bedrooms that are not inventoried as part of storage. But when the items are inventoried in the staff office, there are inventories for those. The biggest thing here is when Robert was transferred from 700 to unit 800 on an emergency transfer, he was going into protective isolation or seclusion, which is in a locked room. So every item he had would have to be inventoried because there wouldn't be any items allowed in his room. So the items shouldn't be on the inventory that when he came over. So none of these items came over from unit 700, and they don't. And when I checked and investigated, they do not remain on unit 700 either.
But tell them how long it took before I figured out that they were missing.
Mr. Schrader, it sounds like Mr. Salito had a question for you. Would you like to answer his question, please?
What was your question?
The question was, I didn't figure out that I was missing these items because I wasn't able to actually watch them go through my inventory, which is what they normally do when we transfer over. So I didn't figure out that I was missing these items until a month and a half later after I got out of seclusion and asked them for my CDs.
Senator Hand?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe the Mr. Salito or Mr. Schrader. We have a document that says that this is the inventory of items placed in locked storage, and it lists a number of things, dated October 9th of 08. And instead of a signature, it says refusal. And my question is, does that mean that, Mr. Salito, you refused to sign that? And if so, why?
What is it?
It's on the storage inventory that you refused to sign it, and that's a refusal, and why did you refuse to sign it?
I never signed anything refusal. I don't remember signing anything refusal on any storage.
Usually what would happen in that situation is staff would go to his room with the property inventory and allow him to review it and sign off on it, and during that time, Robert must have said that he did not want to sign off on it, and then we signed that as a refusal, even though the patient just had the option to decline it.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, and what I was trying to understand was, if he did not sign it, if it's because he felt it was incomplete or if there's some other reason, but or maybe he didn't see it altogether. I'm just not familiar with the process here.
Can I answer something?
Mr. Salito?
Sure.
Can I say something?
Yes, sir.
If I had been in my room, I still wouldn't have been able to know what had come over on storage because I would have never been given the opportunity to go through my stuff or see it.
And in that situation, that's why we do the property inventory, so the patient has the opportunity to look through the items and determine what, if anything, is missing at that time.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, one thing that I've noticed here, Mr. Salito, on your list of missing property that we have a copy of, you list a number of things, CDs and some other things, and you also list a headphones. And on this property list, there does have headphones.
Yeah.
So you're saying that that was on the property list, but you did not
get... I had a couple headphones.
So this is a different pair of headphones.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I think it's important to note also that Robert was transferred over here due to an aggressive act towards a staff member, and there would have been time for Robert to plan this or to give away items, because when you come to Unit 800, which is the higher control unit, you're not allowed a lot of the property that the other units allow you to have. So there's a possibility that items would have to be sent out or re-inventoried or given to family members or whatnot.
Okay, Mr. Schrader, is there anything else that you wanted to let us know before we ask the representative from the department that's here in the room to speak?
I just want to point out that there's no record of an inventory of these items as described from the other unit from Robert. Robert went to protective isolation, so all items should have been inventoried or are inventoried upon that, because no items are allowed in protective isolation other than a set of clothing. Robert admitted that some, if not all, of the CDs were burnt or duplicated, which are not worth the original value. And that he had the opportunity, and patients do have the opportunity, it happens quite often, where they trade or sell their items amongst each other.
But that's not true information. That's what I was disputing, what I wanted to dispute. Because I had burned the 9 CDs that were in storage, and they ended up being on 5 CDRs, which is on the list. I still had 13 CDs in my CD case, and I still had the CD player, which my grandma had just bought me, and I had the CD headphones that I had gotten, too, for my previous birthday or Christmas when I was on 200. And I might have check requests or check records that indicate that I spent that much money on my CDs.
Okay, why don't we...
Mr. Chair, could I just ask one question of Mr. Salido? Mr. Salido, you separated out as if it was a different thing, the summer sausage, and indicated that something happened to it while you were in Unit 800. What happened to the summer sausage?
Okay, when I got to 800, I got approved to get 6 summer sausages. They came in I bought them as 2 entities, 3 and 3. And when they got here, I put them in our staff lounge, where they go into a snack box, and I had 6 summer sausages. The day that I got out of seclusion, which would have been the first day that I would have been able to get a summer sausage out, I made my level 8 so I could eat a summer sausage, and when I counted the summer sausages, one of the staff is like, there's missing a summer sausage, and I only had 5 of them. And what you guys claim is that patient ate the summer sausage. That was the next day. I left a summer sausage on the table, and a patient apparently, I mean, I didn't see anyone take it, but someone right in front of my eyes, I left it on the table, and I went to go get my snack. And, what happened was I left it on the table, and then I went to grab the rest of my snacks from the counter that's in the staff lounge, and the summer sausage was missing. So I'd actually lost 2 summer sausages, but I wasn't claiming the one that I lost due to the patient or whoever took that one. I was claiming the one that I lost the first day I got out of seclusion.
Okay. Is there someone from the department here that wants to speak on this?
Ms. Wike, you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ngozi Chukwu Akubike. When we have aggression at
I'm sorry, ma'am. I'm going to ask you to speak loudly so that they can hear you on the speaker phone.
Okay. When we have aggression by a patient, either against another patient or another staff, what we do is...
Another staff.
Go ahead.
Okay. What we do is to move the patient to protective isolation. When that happens, before we move, there are certain things that the patient is not required or allowed to move with when the move occurs. Why? Because it may be something that the patient could use to harm himself or another person. So in that instance, we have a storage area, and the items are inventoried using a particular form. The patient is given an opportunity to review the items and confirm whether they're accurate or not. Some of them, they refuse. In some instances, they refuse to sign, like in this particular case. In other instances, they sign, and we move the items in the storage. As you can see from the record, those items were never there. And Mr. Salido's his list of items keep in changing. He will say he had the original, and at another point he will say he burnt the CDs. So he has not been consistent in the list of items he claimed were lost.
I would like to see my
Mr. Salito.
Sure, where it says I refused from my check. I didn't ever see that.
Mr. Salito, on the there is an inventory list that we at least have been provided with handwritten list of describing the items, and apparently the staff filled in the word refusal on the patient signature line for representing that you at least declined.
I don't remember ever seeing that paper.
Ms. Akubuike, I have a question. Is the patient allowed to actually personally inspect the contents of the box that is being moved to storage to verify that the items on the list are actually present in the box going into storage?
I would like Mr. Schroeder to, he's the unit director in that area, to shed more light on what the process is.
Mr. Schroeder?
Yeah, when patients come to the unit, we do allow them to go through the items with the staff. However, if the patient moves on an emergency transfer due to an aggressive act, then the patient is not allowed to participate in the actual inventory of the items. And that is the reason that we bring the inventory of the items, the written inventory, to the patient's bedroom, even while they're still in protective isolation, so they can review that and kind of bring up any concerns that they may have or any items that they might think should be there that aren't there. And that's what happened in this case, but Mr. Salito chose not to review that list.
I don't remember ever seeing that list.
Are there any other questions from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson?
Is the date on the storage inventory the date that he went into Unit 800, or was it the day, or what is this, a day before, or I should say, when was the date? It says 10-9-08.
That would be the same day, or if there was enough items, it could possibly be the next day, but our goal is to get it done the same day, so I believe that would be the same day. I could check the progress notes or the medical record to verify that if you would like me to.
So, Mr. Schroeder, is it the department's position that Mr. Salito is making up this list of items that he claims were his?
I would say that with no record of any of these items existing on any of the storage lists that I was able to find in his chart, it was hard for me to believe that these items, all of them, existed.
My problem is that when you're here, they don't make a list of all your items when you're here. And unless it goes into storage, and even sometimes then, they don't put it onto a list. So I've spent over like $400 on my CDs, like $500, $600 on CDs, and the hospital has records of the checks to prove it. Because I always list on the check request and on my special request on 200, on 300, when I was on 700, that I was buying these CDs the whole time.
So, Mr. Salito, you're saying that there should exist some record that you had purchased all of the items that you're claiming were lost?
Yes. I had just recently purchased most of the CDs.
We don't have any record of that in our materials, Ms. Akubuike?
You guys could probably get that record from 200 of from the bank, the checks that I purchased the CDs, because it says it's for CDs. It won't tell us exactly what CDs, but it will say it's for CDs.
Mr. Levicky?
Mr. Chair, I've got one question for Mr. Schroeder. freighter, whichever it is. So he said that he got, for example, the CD player from some family member outside and was sent in to him. And then he talks about buying all these CDs. And apparently no record then is kept of the stuff that comes in. So that, I mean, there is no property list of the property that belongs to Robert Salido while he's in the institution.
And part of the problem with keeping a property list of the property that's on the patients on the unit is that the property fluctuates between the patients. They trade, they barter, they use CDs or other items as kind of payment for other things. And that's where it's really difficult to keep an accurate list of what kind of property they have in their actual rooms. So what we do is we set property limits so they can have like 10 CDs in their room. On this unit, we don't allow any CDs to be in the bedrooms. They can check out one CD at a time from the unit office. And so, yeah, there's not an actual list of every single item that they have, because I just really don't think that would be very accurate, because the patients do trade and sell and give away their items. So
we do not keep the record of what they have in their room. Like when they come inside, we feel that that's part of the taking a personal responsibility of their items. But when they are moved from one unit to the other, in order for us to have an accurate record of the items that they have, that's when we use the inventory and make a list of the items when they are moving.
So that is correct. When we do transfer units, we do inventory all of the items, even if they are going into the patient's possession. So then we have a kind of a starting point if there is problems down the road, that this is what items they came to the unit with.
Mr. Schrader, do you have any inventories of that nature that might be helpful to us in determining whether Mr. Salido actually had these items?
That inventory was provided, I believe. That is the 10-9 inventory, is the exact items that came to the Unit 800 that day.
But had Mr. Schrader, Mr. Salido, had you acquired these items prior to any other transfer from unit to unit, or was all while you were on the unit immediately before going into seclusion?
Yeah, I had those items when I went to 700.
And where were you before 700?
From 200.
From 200 to 700?
Yes, I did.
So, Mr. Schrader, under those circumstances, would there be a record of the items in his possession when he transferred from 200 to 700?
I believe there's roughly 4 or 5 complete inventories based on when Robert did transfer from unit to unit, and I was not able to find the specific items that he is talking about. Most of the items were cassette tapes. I didn't find any bulk CDs on those inventories.
I remember they can trade whatever items that they have. So the record to actually look at is the day of the move.
All right, I think it would be my preference to get a little bit more information on this. One would be to see the other inventories of Mr. Salido's property when he transferred from unit 200 to unit 700. And also to see what records there are of Mr. Salido's or the institutions that payment for purchase of these items. See if there's some documentation that they actually existed before I'm comfortable making a decision on this.
Can I say something?
Yes, sir.
I think if you check the bank statements, you'll see how much money I spent on these CDs, and I know they're trying to say I could have traded them, but there's no evidence that I traded them, and I wouldn't have traded my own CDs that I've never been caught trading CDs or any property.
All right. Mr. Salido, we don't have access to your bank records, so I think it's incumbent upon you, through whatever process is allowed in the institution as well, the department, to give you appropriate access to those records so that you can establish your claim. So I'd be inclined, unless the committee has some other preference on this, to lay this matter over and ask for the additional information that I've just stated,
okay.
so that we can really fairly evaluate your claim, sir.
Okay.
Any other suggestions there? Mr. Salito, are you okay with that?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Okay, then Mr. Salito's claim will be laid over for consideration at another hearing, and give Mr. Salito and the department both our request and an opportunity to present further documentation that these items existed, and then we'll take up the claim at the next meeting. All right, we're going to conclude the hearing on this matter, Mr. Salito. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, what we're going to do next, members, is we're going to skip a little bit on the agenda here. Item 6 on the agenda under the personal injury claims, we have Mr. Arias and his lawyer are present, and Vernon Olson is present. And I think what we'll do is we'll take them in that order. That's the order that they're on the agenda under 6B1. Jorge Arias, so we'll go ahead and take that claim up, and we're done with that. We'll take up Vernon Olson's claim, and then just so the other people in the room understand, typically the property claims that under 6A and the other personal injury claims don't take a lot of time unless there's a particular one that the member of the committee would like to have withdrawn for further consideration. They tend to be dealt with as a group. Am I right, Mr. Lindicky?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So those should be relatively quick so that Mr. Olson, so Mr. Hatcher, you know that we're trying to move along here so that we can consider your claim as much as possible today as well.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lindicky on the Arias claim?
Jorge Arias was working on a sentence to service crew in Hennepin County on August 13th of 07. The crew was apparently sawing what must have been a fairly significant tree down, and a large limb, part of that tree, fell on Mr. Arias' head. He had injuries to his back. He fractured his cervical vertebra. The claim is for $6,108.52 in medical bills. That's at the medical assistance rate, which you need to understand is what our subcommittee pays, not what they bill. And then there's a discussion of whether or not he has a permanent partial disability related to this injury. And the Department of Corrections had suggested that perhaps he needs an independent medical examination to determine if he has a permanent partial disability related to the claim. And I believe Mr. Hartnett indicated that they would order such an independent medical examination.
So Mr. Arias or your attorney, why don't you?
My name is Joel Monke, members of the committee. That's spelled M-O-N-K-E. I'm here with and for Mr. Arias. Mm-hmm. I've communicated with Mr. Hartnett on this matter.
Why don't you tell us what you believe the crux of the claim is here?
Well, I can be real brief here. I'm certainly not.
As you feel you need to.
I'm not going to argue against what Mr. Hartnett said. Mr. Arias was working on a work or a sentence to serve program, as was has been described already, and he got hit on the head with a fairly large tree branch. He has treated. With respect to, and those medical bills have been presented to the department, and we are in agreement that those should be paid as outlined. With respect to the permanent disability, if it's the committee's pleasure, an independent medical examination could be recommended. A 3.5% permanency in the workers' compensation arena translates into $2,625. Frankly, I'm not sure if what the cost of a medical exam is going to be. It might, it could well be in that neighborhood. I do workers' compensation litigation regularly and find that, you know, independent or adverse medical exams, as we call them, can run anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000. So I would recommend that, as Mr. Hartnett's line of 3.5% permanency is appropriate, given the nature of Mr. Arias's injuries, though serious, fortunately, he didn't hasn't suffered, he didn't require surgery, anything of that nature. He has had therapy and regular chiropractic care, as indicated in the report.
Okay. It looks like the submission from the department is recommending that the claim be paid. Last, Mr. Hartnett. Well, first, are there any questions from members of the committee for Mr. Monkey or Mr. Arias? Okay, Mr. Hartnett, would you come forward and tell us what the department's position is on this?
Hey, Randy Hartnett from the Department of Corrections. Mr. Chair, we don't have any dispute that Mr. Arias did sustain an injury when he was working and sentenced to serve. Basically, he broke one of the vertebrae bones in his back. Fortunately for Mr. Arias, that was what was called I can't recall what the medical term the doctors used, but essentially that broken spine wasn't displaced and there wasn't any damage to his spinal cord. Now, when he was initially treated with at the Hennepin County Medical Center, and in September of 2008, Dr. Smith there stated, the patient appears to have functional, which is non-organic pain. His exam is completely normal and his story changes from previous visits. His pain cannot be explained by anything physical at this point. Nonetheless, Mr. Arias has been treating with the Life Medical Chiropractic Clinic. We understand that folks do treat with chiropractors for spinal concerns. My concern about this particular thing is that the chiropractor's office submitted to us for each of the many bills they've submitted a report of the services provided on that day. And in my review of those reports, many of them were exact duplicates, meaning every symptom, every procedure done was listed the same in the same order, or there might be a change of one symptom and everything else was in the same order. That kind of raised my eyebrows, and as I know, as you are aware, I've made that put my concerns about into my report here. It's my understanding, are you still seeing the chiropractor, yes. Mr. Arias? That Mr. Arias is still seeing a chiropractor and we continue to get bills. If he was injured and those bills are reasonably related to his injury, they ought to be paid. My concern was simply the fact that he's been treating with a chiropractor for some time after the medical doctor stated that he no longer had a problem related to this fractured vertebrae.
So, Mr. Hartnett, are you recommending payment of the amount of the claim that has been submitted? Are those just the medical bills at this point?
No, at this point we have received under the MA analysis a chiropractic bills in the amount of $1,950.94. Those are what were received at the time I submitted this. We've since received approximately $300 more worth of bills that we haven't done the medical assistance analysis on yet. And those bills, the latest we have is from last November, so I suspect that there are some that simply haven't been presented yet.
Well, the claim that's been submitted to us, I understand, is the 6108.52. Is that right, Mr. Monk?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And so that's the amount that you're claiming now, which is the amount of the bills that the department responded to in writing.
As obtained and provided to the department. Okay.
And Mr. Hartnett, is the department planning to dispute that portion of the claim? Or do you wish to dispute the chiropractic bills?
Mr. Chair, I don't dispute that part of it. The concern is, of course, is that it. My concern with the medical documentation provided to us by the chiropractor's office looked to me to be unusual in that I would have expected that the findings would have differed, or certainly that it's very well possible that rather than do a new dictation, they simply took a computer file and changed the date.
I would anticipate that they're seen regularly for the same injury, that they probably are doing the same treatment. Unless the symptoms have gone away, it's probably the same symptoms every time, too.
Exactly. If somebody comes in complaining that they've got pain on the right side of the neck, for example, and they obtain a particular course of treatment, and they feel better until that right side of the neck pain comes back, the doctor's in all likelihood going to do the same thing in order to relieve the pain. So I don't think it's unusual that you would find the same same sorts of treatment recounted for a visit. I don't think that's unusual.
So, Mr. Hart, you're not disputing the claim. You just wanted to raise that concern.
I wanted
for
to raise
our
that concern, Mr. Chair, and it was, you know, the subcommittee can make of it what they wish. It's simply the observation I made that many of the reports from the doctor are, in essence, photocopies of previous reports with a change of date.
And where does the question of permanency fit into this?
Well, it appears that as Mr. Monk pointed out, if there is an objective finding of on radiology along with the pain that Mr. Ayres is experiencing, the 3.5% permanency would be a fairly common permanency for cervical back pain. Probably the best analogy to make is that when somebody has a herniated disc and there is no indication that that herniated disc necessarily impacts a specific nerve, the MRI will say there's a herniated disc there, the person has continuous problems. That's a 3.5% permanency at one level.
Is that a part of this claim today, right now? I mean, it's not. Doesn't look like it's included in the 6108.
No, it is not.
Okay.
That would be the medical
right.
The medical part of this. And I do note that Mr. Arya, that the radiographic evidence did indicate that at the site where he fractured his vertebrae, there is one loose fragment. You know, so from the standpoint of that loose fragment being considered an objective radiological finding, I think a 3.5% permanency would be justified.
In addition to the 6108.
That's correct.
And is it the claimant's request that that also be
That would be included, yes. Yes, we would ask that that be included.
And what's the department's position on that?
That's we would go along with that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Hartnett, if we do the 3.5, if this bone spur causes problems in the future, are we considered settled, or is there still a recourse for him to come back on?
What the issue is related to, as you know, the claims subcommittee hears claims for losses that have occurred rather than prospectively. And what we have done in the past is if someone has further difficulties, and we have had a couple of cases over the many years I've been doing this, where we have asked the subcommittee to reopen the case and then relook at the new findings and whatever bills may have been incurred from that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
I would move approval of payment of the 6108.52 plus the 3.5 permanency, but also that we get a second party report on the chiropractic care on expectations of, because this isn't a good number anymore, is it?
Well, that's correct. And what we have typically done in the case where we have an individual who is receiving ongoing treatment and the subcommittee has approved their claim is we ask leave of the subcommittee
to make those payments and to present them to the subcommittee in our under 500 report at the next hearing.
Just to add it, so in line with me, Mr. Arias just received medical care yesterday. He had an injection yesterday, so you know that would not have been included in what's been presented today.
Well, Senator Olsen, would you like to?
Well, Mr. Chair, now I've got another concern because ongoing chiropractic care is one thing, but if it's an injection, is that a steroid or is that from a doctor? So is that something different than what we've been just talking about?
Well, what I understand, it was an injection that included some lidocaine as a pain to relieve pain.
Well, this has got me concerned, Mr. Chair, because we're probably a couple years out of the injury, and if he's getting injections for pain, then we're nowhere near to coming to the end of this case.
Well, I guess the department is going to have to monitor, and at some point the department feels that it's no longer connected to the original injury. Or the department can propose a settlement, to cover all future medical care, and if the parties can agree to a settlement on that amount, I suppose that could be addressed too. But typically, if this were a typical, work comp case, there'd be a global settlement that would, Mr. Monk, you're a specialist.
Well, oftentimes what you do is you leave medical care or medical claims open, subject to the reasonableness and necessity of the services provided. And there's always a defense then to, if you close something off, there's always a defense. If you close liability indemnity off, there's always a reasonable, you can always come back and claim some medical expenses, but again, they're subject to the defense of reasonableness and necessity.
And there's a mechanism for resolving that dispute if there is one.
Yes.
In a typical case. So Mr. Hartnick, could we pay attention to this, and if he has further reason to dispute the chiropractic care or other, whether the injuries or the medical care is still related to the original injury, he could recommend that we deny any future claim. If the department denies it, the claimant has a right to come back to us and see what we can.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if Mr. Lemke had a comment.
Okay. No, I think we probably need to put a dollar figure to that 3.5% permanency as a part of the motion.
Mr. Chair, that's what I was I was trying to do the calculation, but I thought perhaps either Mr. Monk or Mr. Hartnett could tell me how much that is.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, Mr. Monk's statement of $2,625 was
that's exactly
spot
what I came
on.
Up with, yes. And I calculated it. That's wonderful.
$2,625
yes.
Even?
That's right. That's how it
is. So Senator Olsen, is your motion then to pay the medical claim of $6,108.52 and the permanency claim of $2,625 even?
Mr. Chair, and I would also like to see another party review his chiropractic care to see, because I'm concerned about the ongoing, there's concern from the DOC about whether this is legitimate care, and if he's just getting injections, that means there's probably still pain, so there's going to be continuing treatments. So I guess I would like an independent evaluation. Would that be appropriate?
Ask for it, but it costs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, the service that I have a professional technical contract with does have chiropractors on staff, and they can do what's known as a record review. And with the if the subcommittee wishes, I can submit that. There will be a fee. I suspect that Mr. Monk was fairly close when he said it's going to be a fairly large fee. I would imagine it will be in the neighborhood of $1,000. We can do that if that is what the subcommittee wishes.
How much money do we think is at stake?
Right now, the additional funds that we have for the bills we've received have been about $300. And in my, Mr. Monk, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but in my experience, medical assistance generally pays approximately 20 cents on the dollar for chiropractic care. So at this point, we don't have a lot in there. But like I told you, the bills we have so far are not complete, particularly if Mr. Arias has continued to treat. How often do you treat, sir? How often do you go to the chiropractor?
Once a week and whenever I can. I don't really have time. I got a little son to take care of, so mm-hmm. I got a full-time job to do. But one thing, if I can say something on
Mr. Arias,
ever since the accident, you know, the pain hasn't gone away. Ever since I'm sitting down here, I'm in pain right now, you know. I can't sleep at night. I got to sleep always on my back, because if I sleep on the side, on my stomach, it hurts. So basically, that's it.
Well, I'm seeing, do you want to leave it to the department to follow up if they feel it's appropriate?
Yeah, that's a good way to handle it, Mr. Chair. So I would just make a motion to approve the settlement of the 26, 25, and the 6108.
Is there any further discussion on the Senator Olsen's motion? Representative Anderson?
I just want to comment from Mr. Lindeke on his take on other cases like this, or maybe just on this case too. If you have any other thoughts on this, just to enlighten us or give us any other.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the thing that I would say, and I would say it 100 times, is that when it comes to injury claims, and particularly when we're dealing with workers' compensation-like issues and permanent partial disabilities, I have found that Mr. Hartnett is very accurate and spends a lot of time coming up with these recommendations. And I have no trouble at all relying on Mr. Hartnett's evidence concerning this particular claim.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All in favor of Senator Olsen's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsen?
Just for a point of clarification, if we approve this, then you don't necessarily need to come back for our approval on future bills. Wouldn't you just pay them, or because it's contested?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, what we have done in the past and on a handful of cases is that we pay those bills as they come in at the medical assistance rate. And then when we submit to the subcommittee the thing that you just approved earlier when Ms. Lind was up here, that under $500, those are the things that we pay out of our budget to kind of keep the thing rolling. If one of these small claims had to come up here each time, each provider would have to wait an additional year for that to be settled. And that's the reason we have this system. And that's how we would handle it. And at some point, we may very well ask that there be independent chiropractic review, at least of the records.
And I think we left that up to your discretion,
though. I believe that was the case.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Olsen.
We do have Mr. Olsen's attorney on the line, too, Mr. Quinn.
Very good.
Mr. Quinn?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We're going to hear Mr. Olson's case now, so.
Mr. Chair?
Let's just make sure. Mr. Quinn, can you hear us?
I can.
All right. On the telephone, appearing with Vernon Olson, is his lawyer, Sean Quinn. Mr. Quinn, I understand you are up in Duluth. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, you are now, we're on your client's matter before the Claims Committee. You're present in the room. I'm Senator Ron Latz, co-chair of the Claims Committee. The other Senate members are Senator Rick Olsen and Senator David Hand, both of them are present. And co-chairing the committee is Representative Lyle Coonan, who is also here, along with Representatives Bruce Anderson and Mary Murphy. So what we will do procedurally is ask the Claims Committee counsel, Mr. Lindeke, to present a brief synopsis of the claim, and then Mr. Quinn, you can make a presentation on behalf of your client or ask your client to say whatever you like to have him say, and then we'll give the Department of Corrections an opportunity to present their position on the claim. All right, Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Mr. Vernon Olsen was incarcerated at the Minnesota Correctional Facility in Faribault and was lifting a buffer and injured his back. Yep. Hip. And we have had this claim in front of us for a considerable period of time, and during that time, Mr. Hartnett got an independent medical evaluation, which you should have in your files.
I'm sorry, Mr. Lindick, I'm going to interrupt. We don't seem to be able to find the packet relating to Vernon Olson's claim.
It might be to another one.
Is it all the way down the bottom?
And
a big packet.
The independent medical exam is dated March 10th of 2009. I hope Diane or Mr. Jeanette can make sure that everybody can find the newly provided independent medical exam. The independent medical evaluation by Richard C. Strand, an orthopedic surgeon, concludes with these words: "It's my opinion there's no relationship whatsoever to Mr. Olson's hip degenerative arthritis and his buffer lifting incident. He may have strained his low back and he has had multiple surgeries, which is related also to his severe obesity." So we have a new medical exam that indicates that his injuries are not related to the moving of the buffer. That's about where it stands at the moment.
I'd like to go next.
Okay. Mr. Olson, you're represented by a lawyer, and certainly it's your decision what you wish to do, but that's really between you and your lawyer. How he wants to proceed in connection with your testimony.
Well, I haven't had a chance to talk to my lawyer this morning, but I want to point out the mistakes in the IME, and then I'd like my attorney to finish up.
Okay, Mr. Olson, go ahead.
Okay, Dr. Richard Strand, on page one. He said since May of 2008, he really has had no treatment. That's at the bottom. I've been treated for my hip ever since I injured it. I don't know where he comes up with that.
Point that out to us again, please.
The bottom of page one, the last, the third line from the bottom.
Page two. On the first, very first line, he calls Dr. Matson.
It's Dr. Metz.
Metz?
So that's the wrong name, is that right?
It's Dr. Metz, yeah.
Okay. Mr. Olson?
On page four, this is pretty important here. So on the second paragraph, so Mr. Olson was sent to physical therapy on May 24th, 2006. He was seen for back and leg and hip pain, which flared up 3 months before lifting the buffer. That is not, if you go to page 10 of my packet, the medical records, it says he had a flare up about 3 months ago after lifting a buffer at work. Dr. Strand's trying to make that flare-up look like it was 3 months before lifting the buffer. I think that's a pretty big mistake on his part. At the top of page 10, in the medical records, it says he had a flare-up about 3 months ago after lifting a buffer at work. And Dr. Strand has got it 3 months before lifting the buffer at work. I think that's a pretty big mistake right there. And page five are his diagnosis, his opinion. In number one, it is his opinion that Mr. Olson does have permanent disability of his left hip, which is moderately severe to severe arthritis of the left hip. I agree with one. I thought number two, he would not rate a permanent partial disability. And for what he was paid, he at least could have opined on that. He could have came up with a number. And number three, when he says it wasn't related, he said there's no, on number three, there's no evidence of any acute injury to his hip. Well, I don't know, going to the doctor on, when I went to the doctor on February 8th and reported an injury to my left hip. I don't know how he doesn't call that an injury. I didn't have any injury to my hip. It's reported. It's in the medical records. And then it says he has no specific claims of hip pain until a significant period of time after. I injured my hip on February 3rd. On February 8th, I went to the doctor and reported my injury. So I don't know how a week is a significant amount of time. It's not a significant amount of time. And number four, he says it's his opinion that disability is pre-existing. Well, he gave me all but a five-minute exam, and he basically went through these medical records, and as I've shown on the one page, he was very mistaken on that. I was really disappointed in, and if you guys paid for that, you really got took.
Mr. Olson, where did you see Mr. Strand, or Dr. Strand?
I saw him in Brainerd.
And do you know where he's based?
He's based out of Minneapolis, Bloomington. He's, you get what you pay for. And I guess Mr. Hartnett got what he wanted, but I disagree with it. I think the error that he made on just that, of course, if I went in and reported an injury or 3 months before left in the buffer, I can see how he would come up with that determination. But I've clearly shown in the medical records that he is off on that.
Mr. Quinn, did you have anything you wanted to say?
Yes, I do. And Mr. Olson actually pointed out a couple of the things I was going to mention. First of all, I don't know if the committee has the up-to-date records of Dr. Metz. I know I received three separate emails from... who from your committee said it? Mr. Hartnett, attaching all of the medical records that he had. I didn't see the up-to-date records from Dr. Metz in there. Mr. Olson might have them with him right there.
I don't have them, but I did send them. They should be part of your package. I have a couple more things I want to go over.
Mr. Quinn, would you tell us, summarize briefly for us what the up-to-date records would reflect as
sure.
significant in, as far as our determination of the validity of the claim?
Yes, I will. What I'm referring to, there are three pages from Dr. Metz. He's an orthopedic surgeon at Northern Orthopedics in Brainerd. And he saw Mr. Olson on August 13, 2008. Then there was a subsequent telephone call between Dr. Metz and Mr. Olson September 10, 2008, and then the last visit was January 23 of 2009. August 13, 2008, Dr. Metz notes 80 degrees of flexion, which is reduced flexion of the left hip. He also notes zero internal and external rotation of the hip, which is very significant reduction of motion of the hip. And he diagnosed severe degenerative arthrosis of the hip and began talking about chronic pain program and maybe even a total hip replacement. The last visit, the January 23 visit, Dr. Metz notes leg length discrepancy, the left leg being shorter by about half a centimeter, which happens when the hip joint begins to degenerate and the left leg becomes shorter because of the degeneration. Again, no rotation, and he says it's really time to look at total hip replacement, although he wants Mr. Olson to lose some weight before that's done. Dr. Strand, who did the exam just the other day, notes in his examination. This is the orthopedic examination portion of the exam, that Mr. Olson has reduced flexion, the same measurement of Dr. Metz, 80 degrees. And he talks about complaints of pain with rotation, which is similar to Dr. Metz saying no rotation. He also says, I'm judging, he's eyeballing the leg length and says they look about the same. Dr. Metz measured it and it's a half a centimeter off, which doesn't sound like a big deal until you walk with a leg length discrepancy. Again, Mr. Olson pointed out Dr. Strand saying, geez, there wasn't any care right away. This is, of course, not true. There was care right away. Dr. Strand basically doesn't, he reviews the medical records, and he doesn't talk really about any medical care for the hip for some time from the date of the injury until the care that Dr. Strand begins to mention occurs. Mr. Hartnett wrote a rather lengthy letter to Dr. Strand, which was actually very well done, dated March 9, 2009, where Mr. Hartnett went over the medical history. And he talks about visits in February, the same date of the same month of the injury, with left-sided hip pain, left groin pain, and groin pain is a hallmark of hip degeneration. If you've ever talked to anyone who's had a total hip replacement, they don't talk about hip pain, they talk about groin pain. Again, visits in March, in May, in June, all with left hip or groin pain complaints. None of these notes made it into Dr. Strand's report, even though Mr. Hartnett spoon-fed it to him. And so, consequently, Dr. Strand basically ignored all of the medical evidence regarding the temporal relationship between the fact that there was absolutely no mention of hip pain before this incident and continuous mention of hip or groin pain since this incident. And not surprisingly, it was this incident that led to the symptoms and led to the hip slowly degenerating. There's no doubt in my mind, even though there's no record of this, there's no doubt in my mind that Mr. Olson had arthritic changes in his hip before this incident took place. And that's because he's over the age of 30. Anyone over the age of 30 has arthritic changes in their hips and in their back joints and in their knees and any other weight-bearing joint. But that doesn't make them symptomatic. It's the events that turn otherwise dormant arthritic changes into symptomatic changes, and that's exactly what happened here. And now we're at the point of total hip replacement being on the doorstep for Mr. Olson. I would also add, I know that the work comp permanency schedules are used for rating permanency under this scenario. If you look under Rule 5223.0500, that's the rule for hips, subpart 4 talks about loss of range of motion. And if you have less than 90 degrees of extension if you have regular extension but less than 90 degrees of flexion, and Mr. Olson has 80 degrees of flexion, you get a 2% permanent partial disability rate. If you have 0 degrees of internal and external rotation, you get 4%. So he has a 6% disability now with his hip. When the total hip replacement date comes, that will be 8%. There's even a category for leg length discrepancy because of the hip injury, although Mr. Olson's rating would be zero even with the half a centimeter. You have to get over a centimeter to get a rating there. So we have 2% and 4% for the loss of motion, and later on there'll be an additional 8% when the total hip replacement is done. I also would be remiss if, for failing to mention this. I do a lot of workers' comp and other personal injury litigation, and Dr. Strand does a lot of what I refer to as adverse medical exams. I know that they like to call them independent medical exams, but Dr. Strand does a lot of them, and he is rather notorious for never finding injuries whatsoever. The last time I took his deposition, which was in May, so almost a year ago, he agreed with the following statement. Yes, I seem to disagree with treating doctors 95% of the time. And that's when, of course, when he's hired by the insurance companies. In that particular case, my client actually suffered a compression fracture of one of the vertebrae in her spine, and Dr. Strand testified that a compression fracture, which never, it's not like a sponge, it doesn't spring back. Compression fractures never go back. He testified her compression fracture was not a permanent injury, which is just nonsense. And so, you know, I would submit, much like what Mr. Olson has already said, Dr. Strand is not going to give anybody a fair shake here. He's just going to say what he thinks he's expected to say. And in this case, he assumed he was expected to say that this injury didn't result in anything. So he said that, and he ignored the evidence and ignored the reality of trauma affecting underlying degenerative changes. So those are my comments.
Mr. Quinn, for what it's worth, I am familiar with that area of the law and with Dr. Strand's reputation as well, and I would have to agree with everything that you said based on my familiarity with the field. And in fact, I've seen depositions that refer to the amount of money that he's made doing examinations for defendants in these kind of cases, and it would blow your mind. I'm in the seven figures annually. So I think it's, at least for this member of the committee, your comments about questioning the credibility of the independent medical examination is a fair question to raise. In any case, we'll have to, the committee will have to judge for itself how to handle this, but that, at least from that standpoint, I think there's certainly some question in my mind. I know the department might want to have something to say. They've submitted a number of items in writing here as well. But I think probably the biggest question this committee will have to struggle with is whether, in fact, this incident occurred. And then the second question would be, if it did, in fact, occur, what are the consequences? Did it result in kind of a permanency? And if so, how do you categorize that? How do you rate it, and so on. Dr. Strand opted not to rate it because he did not believe there was a causal connection between an incident and the claimed injury. Mr. Olson, did you want to add anything before we ask the department to...
I wanted to add on... I just wanted to point out something in the Department of Corrections medical records. If you look at page 7, that I marked page 7, February 8th, the day I saw the doctor, concern about his back. And somebody with back injuries, back pain, it is common for the pain to run into the hips. So, and all the back problems I had, I assumed that I maybe had injured my back, even though the pain was in both my back and hip. So in the top part, he says he's had 3 back surgeries. In spite of that, he was carrying a buffer up the stairs, he thinks, when he re-injured it. Now, in there, on that first part, when I first reported it, he didn't say anything about left leg pain. So if you just read that, you would think it was just about the back. But if you go down to the March 3rd, the 30-day follow-up, he says the patient is in for follow-up of his chronic back pain. He still, this is the part that shows he's putting what he left out of the first one. Says he still has pain going down into his left leg, but it seems to go more into his left groin. Now, he didn't mention that in the initial injury, but by saying he still has pain, he's pretty much saying, I complained of pain at both times. He just doesn't note it until the second March 3rd visit.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Hamm, what is the amount that is being claimed here?
I don't think there's a dollar figure which is assigned to the amount of the claim at this point, in part because the medical expenses that would be related to it are undetermined because of the potential for a total hip replacement. Well, is that right, Mr. Olson? Mr. Quinn?
You kind of faded out there.
There's no specific dollar amount that's being claimed at this time because if a causal connection is determined, the medical expenses with the potential total hip replacement are not determined yet.
Yeah, we certainly don't know what the cost of the total hip would be. If we were to use the work comp schedules and the work comp payment system, the current permanent partial disability rating of 6%, the 2 plus the 4, you multiply that by $800, so it's $4,800. I know Mr. Olson is also asserting a wage loss related to this hip injury, either immediately or upon the time of the surgery, too.
Senator Hamm,
I'm getting uncomfortable with this process, to be honest with you. It seems, first of all, we're being asked to make some judgments about which we may not have the ability to decide. There are things in dispute about the nature of the diagnosis and what are the relationships between previous existing conditions and the incident that occurred and the things that subsequently we do have. Some sort of competing medical testimony, and you and the witness's attorney have made some characterization of those that may very well be true, but I don't know that person by reputation. I can't judge them fairly. And I'm wondering if this seems to me that sounds like this might be more appropriately handled in court, where these competing claims can be attested under rules of evidence and other procedures that we may not have access to. I'm just uncomfortable trying to decide this. That we are in a position to do that, and maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of what I'm feeling. That I don't know how to judge the testimony of the doctor, for example, and say that we've heard some very prejudicial statements about the credibility of that information, but that person isn't here, and I just am not sure if this is going to be fruitful, at least from my standpoint, of being able to with any certainty judge this one or the other.
Mr. Lendicke, what other process is available, if not the claims committee, for this kind of a matter?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know whether the time has expired to file a claim under the Tort Claims Act, which would allow a person to go to court.
Mr. Chairman, just to continue, I mean, the other part of this is we don't know what the claim is, and I understand that part of the amount of claim is dependent upon our ability to determine what exactly happened, and I'm not sure I feel comfortable about being in a position to do that unless we know that there's different circumstances that this committee may not be prepared to do. I don't know. This is the most. Of all the claims that we've looked at in my time on this committee, this is the one that has been most troubling here.
Senator Olson?
I have a concern, too, very similar to Senator Hamm, but, I mean, what's the expectation that we might end up paying for a hip replacement? It sure seems to me like it's a pre-existing condition. I'm hearing aggravation of a pre-existing condition, but I don't know why we would have responsibility for a hip replacement.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Murphy?
Well, I heard the hip replacement plus the time off of work and lost wages. I heard Mr.
Quinn.
Mr. Quinn said that. And so, and then I have a question about the workers' comp then. He's not eligible for workers' comp disability, but is there a claim under workers' comp?
Mr. Lundeke?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, a prisoner who is injured has only the legislature to come to. They cannot file a workers' comp claim.
So why are we comparing it to workers' comp eligibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, over the 15 years or so that I've been on the claims subcommittee as its counsel, we're not bound by the workers' comp numbers. We don't have to use them, but we have always used them because we also act like a workers' comp situation by not usually judging whether the employee was careless or anything else. We simply pay under the workers' comp schedule because it's a very clearly set out schedule that we can use easily. I'm not saying that we have to, we certainly don't. We're not bound by it. And in the past, we always made a big point of saying out loud, we're not paying this as a workers' comp item. We're just simply using the schedule because it's available to us and extremely convenient.
Thank you for that clarification. This will be good for us because this will be good for our resume that we can go work for the workers' comp.
Senator Hamm?
Well, just to go back, as I said, I think this is unusual in my relatively brief experience here. We're not really being asked to judge upon a specific claim. It's a claim that is pretty unspecific, and we're sort of being asked to decide what that claim is and how much it's going to be worth. And I think I'm uncomfortable that we have the procedures to do that very effectively. And I don't know what the other recourse is, but maybe what needs to happen is that the claim needs to be specified. Here's what we're claiming, X dollars and Y, and then give sort of a format to say yes or no to that or modify that claim. I feel it's pretty open-ended, and we're sort of being asked to get into judging, evaluating doctors' testimonies and getting into understanding what really causes arthritis and degeneration and whether pre-existing things extend and whether it can be aggravated by a specific injury and the nature of the injury. And I'm, without knowing those things, I don't know how I could judge this. I'm not sure I'm the best person. So I'm just very uncomfortable with being able to address this without having more of a specific claim.
Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, this claim looks like it was brought before this committee some time ago before I got on the claims committee. Was there a dollar amount brought forward at that time at the original claim that when it was brought to the committee? I don't see it in here, but I'm just wondering if you might remember or other members might remember, or Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not aware of a dollar amount ever having been specified. Mr. Quinn, is Mr. Quinn still there?
I'm here.
But as long as you've been representing Mr. Olson, you have not specified a specific dollar amount. You're suggesting perhaps that 6% would be the right PPD, and you're suggesting that possibly the cost of a hip replacement would be included at some point, but there is no specific dollar amount that you have ever specified. Is that right?
That's correct. I appreciate some of the comments that have been made about the word. I didn't hear the word premature, but that's kind of the gist that I get from it, which is, geez, we don't. Assuming there's causation here, what's this claim worth? And I can't recall who made the comments, but somebody made the comment, geez, the committee's kind of free to do what they want. They just have used work comp as a guideline. And that's my understanding of that, too. I could evaluate this claim as if it were a workers' comp claim and as if I was making a settlement proposal, and I'm happy to do that. And if you want me to, I'll come up with a figure and make sure it's okay with Mr. Olson and propose it, and I'll explain how I came up with it. I don't know if that's something the committee wants. I'm happy to do it.
Representative Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, the claim, my understanding, was denied before. And if because it was brought forward, and now because of new evidence, it's being brought to us again because of this new evidence that's been brought forward. Am I wrong or am I right on that?
Mr. Chair, to my knowledge, the claim has never been considered and has never been approved or denied. Is that what you recall,
Mr. Olson? Originally, Mr. Hartnett brought it before the committee 1 month after I was released from prison. I was never notified. So,
but my point is that it was never
denied
approved
then.
Or denied at that point.
It was denied then.
Oh, it was. I'm sorry.
So then, see, I was released from prison. I didn't know nothing about the hearing. And I'd been in contact.
This is your first appearance in person before
yes.
this committee.
I appeared by phone last time.
Right, and you're on the phone last time.
If I can interject, my understanding is that Mr. Olson's claim, when it was first considered and denied, and again without Mr. Olson's presence, was denied on the basis that not of the severity or the causation, but whether or not it even happened. And that's because Mr. Olson didn't have an opportunity to present evidence that this event did in fact happen, and now he's provided that information.
And my recollection is the last hearing where there was an appearance by phone, there was also a written statement by the other inmate that Mr. Olson claims he was assisting, a statement that says that in fact this incident occurred, at least that he recalled Mr. Olson assisting him, which was a contradiction from an earlier report, apparently, that the Department of Corrections staff had said that that same inmate had denied recalling the incident occurring at all. So we had some contradictory evidence from that other inmate in the record as well.
Since that went
to the question of did this really happen or didn't it? And then there was another question, was it really a work comp kind of thing? Was he working for, or because there were some questions to whether or not inmates sort of occasionally or routinely assisted each other in carrying stuff up and down the stairs because, you know, because the facilities weren't appropriate to make it happen with an elevator. And was Mr. Olson really assigned to do this, or was, you know, so should this be considered a work type injury under the guidelines here? Ms. Timmons.
Yes. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Michelle Timmons from the Revisor's Office. I was pinch hitting in December for Mr. Lindeke. And what happened, as I recall, at the December meeting is that this case, even though it had been denied before, the committee agreed to reopen it. And part of that was because of Mr. Hartnett's recommendation. Mr. Hartnett had gone back into the medical records. Originally, he had recommended denial because there seemed to be no evidence that he could find corroborating the lifting of the buffer. Then upon re-review of the medical records, there was the entry for the February 8th doctor's visit where Mr. Olson talked about the February 3rd incident with the buffer. And then, but then also because there was a lot of evidence in the medical records of other pre-existing conditions, the committee discussed and suggested that there be in the adverse, the independent medical exam to try to determine what, if a, you know, there is of course an issue as to whether or not this buffer incident occurred, but if it occurred, then how much of the injury would be attributable to that buffer incident. So that's my recollection as to what occurred. I also recall, as you do, that there was discussion about a testimony from the written record from the other inmate that the incident did occur, and there was quite a bit of discussion about whether or not that could be notarized or somehow whether that could be attested to because it was an unnotarized
I'll note, Ms. Timmons, Mr. Lindicky has just shown to me the in the documents that the committee members have, there was an affidavit of Lonnie Branch, who was the other inmate. We had the unnotarized statement or affidavit from Mr. Branch. We now, in our document, we have a notarized statement from Mr. Branch. So, well, there was some questions to the veracity here. At least now we have the notarization. I would note is that it's not that Mr. Branch isn't attesting to the accuracy, or the notarization is not attesting the accuracy of the content of the affidavit. It attests to the fact that Mr. Branch, in fact, signed the affidavit. You still have to judge Mr. Branch's credibility on its own merits. So, but there was some question as to whether Mr. Branch had, in fact, been the person who signed the affidavit, and now that is cleared up.
I've since added another affidavit from another person.
Mr. Olson, what is Mr. Lukowitz's affidavit?
It's basically the same thing. He wasn't in the stairwell to witness it, but we did all our time together, and we worked together every day, and it was just him stating the facts as he knew them. And he did attest to them.
It's also in the members' package. Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, I move that we table this at this time and ask that Mr. Olson provide, Mr. Olson and Mr. Quinn provide with us a realistic expectation of what they're looking for in a claim.
Mr. Olson?
So we can react to that more than what he said, she said kind of stuff in here.
I just wanted to add a little short statement.
But we also have to answer your first question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, about whether or not, whether the incident happened.
And
secondly, if it happened, was it within the work?
That's correct. Those two things have to be answered. But we have to also know what kind of expectation that they are asking us to consider.
Mr. Olson, to that specific point, did you want to make a comment? I mean, just to the motion that is now on the table from Representative Murphy. Mr. Quinn, did you want to, would you be more comfortable, Mr. Quinn, submitting something to us? I think that might reflect the will of the committee here.
Mr. Quinn?
The question was, would I be comfortable submitting, in essence, a settlement demand?
Yes. Or a claim amount that you seek.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that.
Okay. Mr. Hartnett, did you have any comment to make in that regard?
As to what, Mr. Chair?
As to Representative Murphy's proposal.
To table the matter?
To table the matter and get a specific claim demand from Mr. Quinn, and then at a subsequent time we can take up not only that, but also the other more legal questions.
Mr. Chair, if I have a chance to make a few comments, let me frame the subcommittee's view of what the motion, how the motion should be.
Okay, let's ask the department to make a few comments here as well before we make any decisions.
Randy Hartnett from the Department of Corrections. Just to make sure that any confusion related to the procedural posture of this claim is allayed, Mr. Olson filed his claim on November 28th of 2007. At the time, he said he believed that this happened about a year earlier. I was given medical records from the facility going back a year prior to that date, and there was nothing in that indicated that there was a traumatic injury to his hip at that point. What we had in there was an indication of his having been assaulted by another offender, and it was at that point that we recommended denial. Mr. Olson, subsequent to that, sent materials to the subcommittee along with medical records, I assume he requested from the facility. saying, well, here, Dr. Trodson saw me for lifting this buffer, but it was 18 months earlier than that. At that point, I asked for the medical records going back that far, and in fact, Dr. Trodson on February 8th, does report that...
Sorry, Mr. Hardin, I don't want to cut you short, but it seems to me the committee might wish to be laying this on the table to get some more specific dollar amounts here. So rather than, maybe I should get the sense of the committee, it seems to be the direction going, rather than reopen the, discuss the whole question now, the underlying factual questions we'll have to resolve. Before you go into some of that history, Mr. Hartnett, can I get a sense from the committee if there seems to be an interest in not going into that underlying factual discussion now and getting a claim demand from Mr. Quinn before we delve into the decision making on this any further?
Mr. Chair, for me it'd be, you're right, what are we making a decision on unless we're just going to deny the claim, but you have nothing to weigh it against. So I'd be in favor of seeing what their proposal is.
Mr. Hardin, I'm seeing some heads nod and getting the impression that the committee is interested in getting some numbers before we really go any further into making some decisions on the merits of the validity of the claim itself. So I think let's just take any discussion from members of the committee on Representative Murphy's motion. Is there any further discussion on that? All right, then all in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. This matter is laid on the table. We'll ask Mr. Quinn to please present to the committee a claim amount. I guess the committee at its next meeting can...
May I ask a question of just procedure here?
Yes, sir.
How do you want me to submit it and to whom?
Mr. Quinn, I would recommend that you submit it directly to the Claims Committee. Ms. Henry Wangenstein can give you the information off record about how to do that. If you would please...
She's been emailing me, so she can email me the manner in which I can present it.
And if you could please copy Mr. Hartman from the Department of Corrections on that submission, or Ms. Henry Wangenstein can forward that information directly to the department, however you work that out. If you have anything, or if the department has anything that you'd like to submit with regard to the validity or reliability or credibility of the independent medical examination, I think the committee would welcome some more information on that to help the committee determine how to approach that question as well.
Mr. Chair, perhaps Mr. Quinn's firm could obtain their own medical evaluation as well.
Mr. Quinn, the department has indicated that they would welcome it if your firm wished to obtain your own IME in this matter. It sounds procedurally like this committee really has little choice but to delve into some of these underlying questions because of the nature of the way the claim arose in the Department of Corrections.
I understand. What I would likely do then is just frankly present information much like what Mr. Hartnett did to Dr. Strand, except I'd present it directly to Dr. Metz, the treating doctor.
That would be your prerogative, and the committee will evaluate whatever information we have before us at the next meeting. We have not scheduled another meeting yet this year, or this legislative session. It would be my desire, if we can find a way to do it, to hear this matter, if we can, to resolve it before this legislative session is over so it can be included in the claims bill. But we may or may not have enough time to accomplish that, but I'd certainly like to try to move if we can to do that. So at this time, we're going to lay this matter on the table subject to further proceedings.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Quinn. Mr. Olson?
Thank you.
I think we should perhaps have a conversation with the committee about what we want to do procedurally now. It is 1:30, which is the time the hearing was scheduled to conclude. We have, I would anticipate, some relatively quick matters that could be resolved. I have a 2 o'clock appointment very close to the Capitol that I need to attend, but it should not take more than, say, 30 minutes. So if the committee is interested and willing, we could return after that time to take up any remaining business, or we could defer it to a subsequent committee meeting. That would include Mr. Hatcher's claim, which he was gracious enough to let us know would take up a lot of time, and so we might want to schedule a special meeting to deal with that and Mr. Olson as well. Mr. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, prior to that, Mr. Jeanette's suggestion, I did contact those claimants that we presented who are not incarcerated. I did let the ones I was able to contact know that the meeting was taking place. No one told them they were going to be here, and it doesn't appear as though anyone else is here, but I would ask that the chair pull the room to make sure we're not having another individual sitting here who traveled.
Thank you. That's a very good suggestion, Mr. Hartnett. Is there anyone in the room who is a claimant or who has traveled here in connection with a claim on today's agenda that would prefer to have that claim heard while they're here now? The record should reflect no one has raised their hand nor spoken up.
Mr. Hatcher coming back?
I don't know. Mr. Hatcher appears to have left the room, but he did not state to any of us that he was planning to depart for the day, so perhaps he has just stepped out momentarily. I guess we'll take a look.
Are there other witnesses for other bills that are here?
Yeah, well, other than the department Mr. Hartnett, you're here. I don't know if you have any other staff that are here from the Department of Corrections in connection with any of the other claims besides yourself.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lind, who is here to present those 3 property claims, is here. If we could get those settled, I suspect they will be fairly quickly, then she could be excused, and I'm certainly available to return after a period of lunch or something like that.
We should also, it's another point which none of us have had lunch unless we squeezed it in surreptitiously here. Probably most of these other personal injury claims could be dealt with rather expeditiously too, unless there was a member of the committee wanted to pull one out specifically for further discussion. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, this is different than a lot of times when we meet where the personal injuries and the property claims are kind of flipped around. Usually we have 40 Nike tennis shoes missing, So I suspect there's going to be a lot of, we're going to have to do some pretty due diligence on a lot of these injuries. And, I just don't know if we can move through them as quickly as the personal property ones. Those can go pretty fast, but mm-hmm. I was just thinking these may take some more time.
Well, is the committee interested in coming back at about 2:30 or 2:45 to continue working on this matter? I mean, we can work, until 10 to 2 anyway and see how far we get in terms of my own schedule. I don't know what other schedules are. I want to be cognizant of that as well.
Mr. Chair, where do you live?
I live in St. Louis Park.
Yes.
And you live in St. Louis County.
I understand.
Friday afternoon.
And was it your intent to return home today, Representative Murphy?
Indeed it was, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Anderson is not quite as close as some of us as well.
Mr. Chairman,
and Mr. Representative, boy, the entire House membership is not within 10 miles of the
And Mr. Chair, we haven't been home since early Monday morning.
I understand. I do not wish
our
to.
Our clothes are dirty, Mr. Chair. Our friends are waiting, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would suggest that we do the property claims now and then maybe adjourn to another date.
I would guess that would be the committee's consensus, which I am perfectly fine with, of course. why don't we address the property claims now?
There's somebody over
and
there.
Then, yes.
Is that a decision then on Mr. Hatcher's claim so I know whether I can
Are you here?
I'm with the department and I didn't report
on it. Okay. Yes, well, Mr. Hatcher seems to have left, and I don't know. Our staff has taken a look. Of course, you couldn't go into the men's room if that's where he went.
Mr. Chair, if he intends to actually talk for an hour or more, then we really have to put him off till another meeting.
I agree with that. I think what we'll do is we will not take up Mr. Hatcher's claim today either, so the department can leave. Ms. Akubuika, did you?
Yeah, I have a question whether you still handle the amendment, the proposed amendment.
I think we're not going to take up the proposed statutory amendments today either, unless the property claims get done in 5 minutes, in which case we could probably have some discussion on that. If you're here in connection with those, maybe you should wait. And we'll see if we have a chance to start a discussion on that. And then we'll make a commitment to adjourn by 10 to 2. Is that satisfactory to the members from the House? Will that give you enough time to get home before dark? All right, then.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lindeke?
The three, as far as I'm aware, we only have the three property claims.
Were there some added to the
start on the agenda?
Okay, let me see the new agenda. Mr. Jeanette, how many property claims
you got
do we have?
Agenda.
We
have five property
claims. We have five property claims. All right. I didn't have
all
that.
There were the two added ones here.
All right.
Robert
and so can I see the back of those?
Yes.
All right, that one. What did I write about this one?
Let's do what we can, and what we can't do, we will reconvene again.
In my recollection, on all of them, I recommended denial. I know on the four that I can see my denial words. That was my recommendation.
Mr. Lindeke, let's start with Mr. Villebrum. The claim from Mr. Villebrum.
All right. Mr. Villebrum claims that he lost his Nike tennis shoes. The department's response was that the loss of these, they were put in a bio bag and turned into the discipline unit as evidence. They were destroyed as a biohazard. They could not be kept. This was not negligence on the part of the department.
Mr. Hartnett, didn't we see this claim?
Mr. Chair, indeed, the subcommittee did see this claim, and you asked me to look further into the matter of getting restitution from individuals who assault other offenders.
Yes.
I had some lengthy talks with Deputy Commissioner Christ and with the Associate Warden of Oak Park Heights, who is an attorney that used to work in our legal services unit and had a particular interest in this. The problem with the issue of asking for offenders to pay restitution related to property against other offenders is it is not allowed under the statute. And I sent this morning, gave you packets with some information about our claims. The back of those are copies of those two statutes. Unfortunately, my copies have gotten lost in all this paper I have here, so I can't give you the citation. But the commissioner is permitted by law to get restitution from offenders when it's been ordered by the court or when it has been ordered by a hearing officer for damaging property belonging to the state, for damaging property belonging to employees, or for injury to other offenders, but not for property damage to other offenders.
So then the question would be twofold. One is, would it be the will of this committee for the state, on behalf of the Department of Corrections, to pay Mr. Villebrum for the loss of the Nike sneakers that were bloodied in the course of an inmate assault? medical and safety reasons disposed of following that. And then I think the second question might be a little broader one, whether or not we feel it's would be a good change to the statute to allow restitution between inmates.
Mr. Chair, if I can interject, our department has been looking at that, and of course the difficulty is that if we introduce another method by which offenders can get money, particularly from other offenders, we have a significant concern about fraudulent claims being made.
Or incentive to damage property,
et cetera. Now, obviously, if one offender is being asked to provide restitution to another offender, that's going to limit collusion between those two offenders because it would be a zero-sum situation. However, unfortunately, we do have offenders who conspire against other offenders in order to gain their property, and that's part of the problem. So I would ask that the subcommittee, if they propose that the department have a chance to review that.
Of course we would. Representative Murphy.
I understand the situation, but do you have a procedure does the Department of Corrections have a procedure for determining when something is biohazard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, our policy, bloodborne pathogens policy, requires that anything that's contaminated with blood be considered a biohazard.
We can't wash them.
I'm not an expert in the field of bloodborne pathogens, but we do have folks who are, and that is the way our policy is that, and as the subcommittee will recall, this isn't the first time that bloodied clothes have been, claims have been made.
Senator Olson?
To the House members, last time we had quite a discussion about why doesn't the DOC just allow a certain kind of cheap shoe, just like, you know, they're issued, you know, the clothes they wear are issued by the state. And we got into a pretty deep discussion about, because they mean something in prison, you know, if you're wearing Nikes or all that. And so we've had that discussion. And I think it's worth visiting though sometime but then I think part of it was that a lot of them really play sports during their time that they can, and they're pretty competitive, and you know, if they were wearing the cheap little penny shoes that
I understand that.
But it is amazing how many shoes issues that we see before this committee.
Because they're very bad.
Senator Olson, as Mr. Lindeke could attest, when I first started doing this 14 years ago, there were lots of classes of property that the offenders could have claims for that they're not allowed to have anymore. For example, we had lots of different types of TVs. Now the only TVs that they can order are the TVs with the clear plastic cases so that they don't need to be taken apart to check for contraband. We have had, over the course of years, we've tightened up considerably on the amount of property that offenders can have. Now, I'm not directly involved in property claims anymore, so I have to defer to Ms. Lynn's expertise, but it is her belief that shoes have now gotten to the point where they're going to be specifically limited to certain kinds. And, of course, anytime we do that, it would be an enormous expense to the state to not grandfather the shoes that are already in our prison in addition to being poor correctional practice, because every time you limit a prison population in some way that has that the prisoners can make have a belief that is unfair, in other words, why are you taking my Nike shoes away from me? The number of incidents that we have of requiring discipline or security issues goes up.
Mr. Chair, I understand all that, and I understand the value of good tennis shoes also when you're doing things. And I also understand that grandma or auntie or mom or dad probably contributed the money to buy those shoes.
Claim before the committee right now is a claim for the tennis shoes which were destroyed under the biohazard policy when one inmate assaulted Mr. Villebrun, caused a lot of blood to be spilled onto the shoes. Mr. Villebrun is asking the state then to pay him back for the shoes that were disposed of under the biohazard policy. And I guess the only question I have in terms of deciding this particular claim on the merits is whether we have to believe that the state was somehow negligent in the process to be responsible for paying it back, or if it should be automatic, sort of strict liability standard. And I'm not sure that we want to have the state always reimbursing inmates when they've got lost property just because of the fact that they lost property. So there has to be some connection to the state being responsible for it.
Mr. Chairman, I guess given the additional information about the chances or the wisdom of trying to get restitution from another inmate, and I take your point, I want to move that we accept the claim, and here's why. I think if in some way, I guess you could say that the state is responsible because we have a policy that requires that these things be disposed of in case they get blood on them. If you're not in prison, having blood on your shoes isn't necessarily considered a biohazard, and you don't have to lose them. So I guess I feel that it is a little bit of a problem in my view that someone gets hurt and they get blood, and in the course of that they lose their clothing and they have no recourse to gain it back because of policies that we've adopted as a state. I think that's, there may be some problem, right? And I don't necessarily want to write a state law to that effect, but maybe we ought to accept this claim and think about, is there a way to deal with that? But that would be my motion, to accept the claim.
There's a motion on the table. Mr. Hartnett, could you say whether, I would assume, is all the clothing that they wear, is that issued by the state, or are there other items that inmates purchase that if they got into a fight and got some blood on it, we'd see claims for?
Mr. Chair, I don't know to the answer to. Inmates are allowed to wear some degree of personal clothing. I personally don't have a good feel as to what level that is. They buy sweatshirts, for example, in the commissary for workouts, gloves, that sort of thing. If the subcommittee will entertain claims related to clothing that's discarded or destroyed because of policy reasons, I can guarantee there will be claims. We have had a number of claims where individuals have asked for reimbursement for clothing that had to be cut off of them because they were refusing to undergo an unclothed body search because of a security issue. We found that rather than try to risk injury to the offender or to our staff by forcibly removing clothing to do an unclothed body search, we simply cut it off in those situations. We've had claims like that. We've also, at one point, had and Mr. Lindeke may recall this one, a claim for laundry after the riot in Stillwater St. Cloud several years ago. One of the inmates that had been involved in the rioting put in a claim because his clothes were thrown out because they were contaminated with CS gas because there was a riot going on. So yes, there will be claims. In this particular case, it would be obviously Mr. Vilbon in this particular case didn't have any fault here. I know that Mr. Lindeke doesn't care for bringing in some of the other story on these things, but I would like the subcommittee to know that Mr. Vilbon himself lost a shirt a few weeks later in an assault that he had perpetrated.
wouldn't accept that.
I wasn't against the individual in this case. That individual was in segregation. But
Senator Olson?
I was wondering if Senator Hahn would be open to an amendment.
Sure.
And that would be to purchase replacement shoes off of the new list instead of a Nike.
Nicole Lynn, Department of Correction. I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you're...
Instead of replacing the $50 shoe, $52 value in shoe, either, you know, replace it, because Mr. Hartnett talked about there's a new list that they can buy from.
Correct. Well, we have replaced his tennis shoes with state-issued shoes.
Okay.
They don't pay for the state-issued shoes, but, I mean, if he wanted a fancier pair...
Is that available on that list?
On the list.
And that would be cheaper than the 52, or?
I don't know the prices offhand. But we did give them shoes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe in light of this further discussion, I'll rescind my motion to accept the claim. I think the department is making a fair point about we probably don't want to open ourselves up to claims that would be. We might be inundated with them.
Yeah.
I'll move to deny.
Representative Murphy, you had your hand up before, and I didn't get to.
Well, I was going to offer an amendment because it doesn't say they were new shoes, so I was going to say $30. Because they don't.
All right, well, there is a motion on the table from Senator Olson to deny the claim. Is there any further discussion of this motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails. The claim is denied. Out of respect for the distance that the House members need to travel to return home for the weekend and other scheduling commitments, we will adjourn the meeting now. And I don't see how, unless you think the next couple claims are going to be even faster.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke reported that he had recommended denial on the other four property claims. If there are any members that want to discuss those, obviously that's an issue. But if
we need to have each of them presented anyway. Are you okay staying for a few minutes yet to come and see the other four property claims? Let's see how quickly we can give them fair consideration.
Mr. Chair, this is the claim of Scott Seeley. Scott Seeley is claiming the loss of a bunch of stuff that is not inventory. These are the canteen items like the deodorants, the brush, Q-tips, lip therapy, and stuff like that. He's also claiming the loss of some tennis shoes. There's no indication that he ever owned those shoes on any prior inventory. And he's claiming the loss of an Ojibwa dictionary, which is apparently being held for him in at property at Stillwater. At least that's what we understood.
Correct.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson?
Was this in a move or something, or, I mean?
A sense of segregation, I believe.
Correct. He was sent to segregation.
I move that we accept the recommendation of counsel.
Representative Murphy moves to deny the claim. Is there any further discussion?
You did recommend.
There is another.
I don't see a recommendation on this.
Well,
new version we got.
Mr. Chair, I didn't make the copies. We're going to.
Oh, I'm sorry. There was. There was. No, hold on. There was an amended submission in this place. The additional replacement handouts for today's meeting, number two. Is Scott Seeley's claim. Still. All right, any further discussion of the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Claim denied.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is a claim by Brooks Peterson, who was at the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Faribault. Claims a loss of various personal items like toiletries, food, state-issued clothing he's claiming a loss of, and some tools when he was moved from his cell. He was in a two-person room. He was at work when these items, and then he was sent to segregation from work. They packed up the items that were in his room that belonged to him after he got sent to segregation. Any loss is not caused in this case by employee negligence, and I recommend denial.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
I move the recommendation of counsel.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Linderman.
Mr. Chair, I have a claim here by Roderick Hamilton, MCF Rush City. He claims some Nikes were lost. He had some Nikes as well. It becomes apparent that at some point he did have these shoes, but they were not part of the property packed up when he was sent to segregation. Mr. Hartnett and Ms. Lind always remind us that just because they did at one time own a nice pair of Nikes doesn't mean they had them at the time they got sent to segregation. They may have traded or sold them to somebody else. In any event, we don't know what happened to the shoes, and there's no clear evidence stated in this claim of staff negligence. I recommend a denial.
We seem to have a recurrence of property claims where property was lost and there's no inventory reflecting it.
Mr. Chair, by way of clarification, I think in that case there was an inventory. It's just that the alleged shoes were not on it, and we have to assume that they weren't there when the pack-up was done.
I'll make discussion.
Motion to deny. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, the last of these is by Howard Lackowitzer, who is at the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Stillwater. He claims this is a claim for $14.15 for the loss of shower shoes, shorts, and a utensil set, which apparently when there was a shakedown, something happened to these items. There's no evidence of any staff negligence in the loss of these items. Nobody knows what happened to them. I recommend a denial.
I'll move denial.
Discussion on Senator Olson's motion. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Lind, I take it when you lose your shorts, you get another pair back from the state?
Correct.
All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, we consider the property claims? Okay, then the other items on the agenda will not be taken up today. They'll be taken up at the next committee meeting, which we will attempt to schedule promptly enough so we can act on it still this legislative session, but with enough time for the information that we've requested to be provided to us.
At which meeting, Representative Coonan will have his first experience as the chair of this subcommittee.
Yeah, another first. Mr. Chairman, this is my first meeting, and that will be my first meeting the chair with this committee.
Mr. Hatcher, thank you for your patience today, and at the next meeting, there probably will be less on the agenda, and we will be able to give a fair consideration to your case.
Thank you very much.
At that time. So, Representative Anderson.
This, Mr. Chair, letter that's on tort claims, new procedure for handling tort claims, will we be taking that up at that time too?
If there's a desire to discuss it, certainly put that on the agenda. Would you like to discuss it?
Well, Mr. Chair, it was in my packet, so I'm just wondering why.
Hold on. Why don't we ask
Mr. Abu?
If we could ask her to address the new procedures for responding to our claims, that would be all right. We're adjourned.
Well, these are held over.